seconds on this. Record. Okay, and record, and record. There we go. Alright, I don't want you doing that anymore. Okay.
Hey, Zeke, are you there?
Yes, sir. I'm having a problem with my audio. Can you hear me?
Hey, GP. Hello?
This could be a fun meeting.
Yeah. We don't have AGP.
Be sure.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. They don't have the meeting recording either, so they haven't started it.
Okay, go ahead. Let's do that. And there we go. There we go.
Do we have a number for them?
There's one on their screen.
I don't have. Normally it's Zeke that does it. I don't have his contact.
And Scott, Dana.
I don't think. Maybe I do.
I do see the little recording button up there.
Oh, now it's on. So maybe we're maybe.
Oh, maybe they're there.
Are they talking to us?
Yeah. Let me go. Let me have this. Okay. Okay. And.
So are we live, Scott, or does somebody have a TV?
No idea. Not sure. What's up?
Okay. Call Dana.
Which one? Which phone number for Dana Swanson? Call him now.
Hey,
it does look like we're live on the website.
I sure can.
I don't have communication with the council. The planning commission.
I'm looking at the city's. I'm looking at the city's stream on their website. We're on.
Yes, we'll
thank you.
All right.
So we should do something interesting.
You first, Nancy.
I'm not a volunteer.
Sounds like a staff responsibility to me.
Right? Well, Scott, we probably could start the meeting. I'm just going to try to confirm with Bob.
It does look like we're live on the website. Looks.
Hello, this is Zeke with AGP. Can anybody hear me? Hello, this is Zeke with AGP. Let me see this.
Nancy, you're on the TV on channel 20, so.
Awesome.
Okay, I guess we have an issue. Zeke called and said called Dana and said we're rolling, so we can start.
Okay, let's see.
What the scoop is, but.
So we got, let's see, we got it. Is Jesse here? Okay, he's not
Jesse's
showing up on my screen.
He's if you look at the panelists and attendees, he's there.
Yeah.
He's okay.
All right, yeah, so go ahead and start it.
Okay, we'll bring this to welcome everybody, and we have a quorum. All members are present. This is the regular scheduled meeting for Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. And we're trying to hold this through teleconferencing. We'll see if it works or not. So establish a quorum is established. So I'll call the meeting to order. Do we have, does any of the planning commissioners wish to make any announcements?
Hey, Jerry, I just wanted to say, it looks like I got something in the mail, email, that says the Governor's Office of Planning and Research is going to have an updated environmental justice guidance for general plans webinar tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And if you look at that website, Office of California Office of Planning and Research, I think you'll see the access to it. I think it was sent to me because I'm on some lists from them. I didn't see anything that said it wasn't open to the public or that it had a limited capacity to receive visitors. So the idea of environmental justice in the general plan, I think, is a fascinating thing before we finalize our general plan. And I'm going to try to attend that virtually and see what is said.
Okay, that looks like something that may be a requirement for our plan update.
We have an environmental justice element. It's a requirement.
Yeah.
It's in there.
So you think that they're probably going to be upgrading that?
Yeah, we'll have to see. I would imagine, I mean, we don't have Amy on the call yet. She'll be hopping on in a little bit. She might have a little more information about that. I don't know.
Okay. Do we have any other announcements from the planning commissioners? Okay, seeing none. We'll open the meeting for public participation or public comment, and this is for items not on the agenda or items that are on the consent calendar. If you can either use the Zoom access, or if you would like to telephone in to 408-638-0968 or 669-900-6833 or 346-248-7799. And the webinar ID is 827-2274 and 7698. And the password is 135-692. And you, to raise your hand, press 9. I guess we can't tell if we don't have AGP. Can we tell if anybody's wishing to make a public comment?
So I can see it. I don't see anybody in the queue with their hand up. It doesn't look like anybody's on a call-in, so I don't have just numbers sitting there. So it looks like maybe they're just waiting for us to start the housing element section. Maybe they'll talk then.
Okay, so we'll close public comment and move on to item A1 and A2, the consent calendar. Does anybody wish to address any of the items or pull any of the items on the consent calendar? No? Okay. Any discussion? Seeing none, can we have a motion?
Move to approve the consent calendar.
I'll second that.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion or second? Okay. Scott, would you call the roll?
Sure. Commissioner Lucas?
Aye.
Commissioner Stewart?
Aye.
Commissioner Barone? You're muted, Jesse. I'm going to go ahead with aye. Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Commissioner Ingrappia.
Aye.
Chair Lure.
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, guys. Okay, we're moving on to public hearings. This is item B1, and this is a continuation of the housing element update for 2020 to 2028. And this is a continued item from July 7th, 2020. And do we have a staff report on this? Or
so I can kind of give you an update, and maybe you know, Nancy can jump in where I maybe miss things. But you know, from the last meeting, you know, you got through most of the housing elements and leading right up to the goals, policies, and implementation section. The Planning Commission also formed a subcommittee of Commissioner Lucas and Commissioner Stewart to put together a vision statement. That vision statement and associated documentation is included in the staff report as exhibits G and H. We also, for the staff report, updated our response to comments. That's exhibit D. And we provided you an exhibit E and some discussion in the staff report about direction that was provided by the Planning Commission and I think related to potential impacts that might have on having to have a re-review with HCD. So you see that in exhibit E, where there's a couple of items that you talked about. One was the increasing the cost per square foot. That likely will generate some interest from HCD, so we would have to go through another review process with them. It's up to a 60-day review process. Hopefully it would be shorter than that, though, because they've already seen the document. And then the item that you added related to the safe parking program, we'll be including that in there. And that potentially also has ramifications that HCD might want to see, although a little unclear. Maybe they'll be fine with it. So I think that was about all I had. Nancy, did you want to add anything?
Just the staff report was updated to include kind of a sample timeline. The timeline assumes that the housing element is adopted tonight, no pressure. But it just was done that way just to show you that there's a lot of things that require notification and timeline. And so I wanted to assume something. So I assumed adoption tonight, then it goes to City Council, then it goes to HCD for review, another second review of statutory compliance. Then it goes back to City Council for adoption because we're assuming City Council might make some changes that HCD is going to need to see. So it needs to go back to City Council for adoption, and that needs to occur before the end of the year. If it doesn't occur before the end of the year, there might be a grace period, but I don't think they've announced one yet, and then that would put us out of compliance.
Okay.
So I would say, you know, at this point, before you hop back in, and certainly this is a continued public hearing item. You do have a few folks in the queue. I don't know if any of them would like to speak on this item again, but if they do, it might be appropriate now to take public comment in case there is any, and then hop into the review of those items.
So yeah. I also wanted to mention that there were two additional letters that came this week. I think one yesterday and maybe one today. Those were emailed directly to you, and they were also posted on the website. Every other piece of correspondence that we received on this item, the bulk of which were prior to the previous hearing, are attached as an exhibit to your staff report.
Okay, great. Thank you, Nancy. At this point, I think... Yeah, I think you're right, Scott. Let's go ahead and let's open it up for public comment and see if there's any members of the public that wish to speak to this item.
Mr. Chair, this is Zeke Turley.
Can you hear me? Raising their hand. Oh, no. Well, we have Betty Winholz. Okay, Betty, I think you should be able to talk now.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Faintly.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, thank you. I just want to hit a couple of the highlights of my last rendition of the review of this document. Mostly cautioning about the language in terms of extremely low, very low, low, and moderate, and how those all interact with the term affordable and workforce. And would encourage you, if you're going to use the terms affordable and workforce, that you define those in terms of extremely low, very low, low, and moderate income, so everybody can be on the same page in terms of what those words mean. I also want to add support to Ms. Winter's communication I saw regarding mobile home parks. That it is the residents there that I'm more concerned about than the homeowners, or not the homeowners, but the park owners. I think there needs to be a balance, but I think she raised some good points, and I hope that you'll look at those. My point about that only one of the action items seemed to have a quantified objective, and the others did not, and I was curious why that one had one and nobody else did. if that could be answered. And the whole thing about the homeless situation and not providing safe parking, and then a warming shelter, of course, those I think you still want to, and you imply that you would be addressing those this evening. And then, okay, then the last implementation action, again, it seemed like that was pretty cookie cutter, and I hope that you'll make that relevant to Morro Bay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Betty. Is there anybody else, Scott, that would like to speak to this?
I don't see anybody else with a hand up, but Linda Winters. Hi, Linda. You're on. There you go. You were on mute. Can you hear us?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, great. Thank you for allowing me to speak, and I understand that you received my letter as far as information about the mobile home parks, and I will reintroduce myself. I'm Linda Winters, new to these meetings, but familiar with city council meetings, attending every meeting for the past year on behalf of the residents of mobile home parks here in Morro Bay. I've sent an introductory letter to the entire commission today explaining our position regarding the housing element report and mobile home park residents. We are very interested in being a part of some sort of coalition with the city and the 1,000 residents that are a part of Morro Bay's mobile home park residents community. We live in our homes, but rent the spaces that our homes are placed. A unique way to live. We love our lifestyle, and we'd like to maintain it till our dying day. We are not wealthy, but we help the city of Morro Bay. We share our talents, shopping, working locally, volunteering freely. We want to keep our homes at prices that we can afford on our retirement and Social Security pensions. And we hope to form a strong coalition with the Planning Commission on making that all happen. There is one other issue I would like to mention. It's about the placement of the affordable housing units proposed at 405 Atascadero Road, directly east of Highway 1 and Main Street intersection. The traffic there is already a nightmare. I'm very concerned that this project will make it impossible for our residents to even get to their homes. I agree with Ms. Stewart that we should have a multi-level, multicultural, multi-financial status community. Something for everyone. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Linda. Linda, is there anybody else, Scott, in the queue?
I don't see anybody else with their hand up.
Okay, is there anything you'd like to address on either Ms. Winters-Holtz or Ms. Winters' comments?
Not at the moment, unless the commission has specific questions about the comments. I mean, we have the letter from Ms. Winters-Holtz and from Ms. Winters, and we'll, like similarly we've done with other correspondents, we'll provide responses to those as we move it forward to City Council.
Okay, great. Thanks. Okay, so moving on, I think we should address the mission statement at this point. Do we have a slide on that, or could somebody do a screenshot of it?
It's at the end of the staff report. Can you put that up, Scott?
While he's searching for that, do we have definitions for affordable and workforce housing in the document, Scott? I didn't see those.
I think that's going to be a moving target, Jerry. Wouldn't it be right, kind of year by year, probably established by the state or federal?
Well, I think the terms are generally used in the industry, but the housing element is part of the general plan, so I haven't had a chance to look and see if there's I mean, we were also asked if the term local with a lowercase L is defined in the document. And so, and I think some of these things we have to look at the bigger document, because that's why the housing element doesn't have an index, because it's part of a larger document. So the definitions may be defined in the general plan.
Okay, so do we have, so that would basically, you know, workforce housing and affordable housing would be linked to low, ultra low, or moderate housing in the general plan then, the definitions?
I think when someone's talking about low income or moderate income, they're talking generically about moderate income and income less than moderate income. I didn't think we used the term workforce because I didn't think we had a definition in this county for that term.
Okay, we just need to make sure that our definitions are...
have definitions for that, but
are clear.
We don't have them in our ordinance.
Okay.
So you want me to try to share the screen and pull those things up?
Yeah, if you could pull up the mission statement, that would be great, Scott.
Okay, we'll give it a shot. Okay.
Otherwise, we're going to have Michael read it to us.
And if you want later, I found the definition of affordable housing in the general plan document.
Thank you.
Great.
Okay, this was... So we have the... vision statement piece in Exhibit G on the screen now, and then sort of the revised introduction. I'll let the subcommittee, you know, say where they want to start the conversation and what they want me to have on the screen.
Okay, Susan or Michael would
so
who wants to take point?
I think what we did was start with the general plan vision. We looked at, you know, what the housing element introduction was, and Michael pulled up other things from the Chamber of Commerce text. And so we sort of discussed all of these issues. And what I did was took all of Michael's sort of pieces that he pulled together and stuck it into one page, because seemed to me having something kind of condensed and short for a vision statement would be easier. So it's just kind of a starting point, I think. Does that sort of jive with you, Michael?
Yeah, I think we didn't want to have to reinvent the wheel. There were so many things that as we looked at the other texts that were already stated beautifully. We didn't want to contradict what was stated. So that's why in H, which was the first document we did, it literally shows you where the genesis of the text is from. So you can actually see in green the things that came from the general plan that we thought would be nice to potentially restate. And then there's things from the Chamber of Commerce letter that I felt were particularly poignant, and I threw those in. And then the text in black was the text that was in the housing element now. So you can literally see where this was meant to kind of be a few paragraphs before the existing text that was there. And then, you know, Susan did a Occam's razor reduction down to a little bit more brevity, which I don't have any trouble with. I think it's one of these things that when you approach housing, it's just like our discussion with the some of the public comment about the mobile homes. It's like you expect things to be in the housing, so sometimes you want to say, well, what's not going to be in here as well as what is going to be in here. And the idea of especially saying at this time, these are our problems, and this is what we're trying to work on within this housing document for the 8 years. So those things are all sort of meant to be showing up in that vision. So I would say, you know, looking at Exhibit G is a good place to do any wordsmithing. And if you'd see anything in the previous one that maybe was too much of a reduction, we could certainly take a look at that, adding things in. But I think G stands on its own as a pretty good way to start.
Any other comment from the other members of the commission? reading through it, I think you guys did a pretty good job. Scott, did you have any, or did the staff have any issues with any of the statements?
I mean, I think we would, you know, probably want to take it and edit it, you know, a little bit to fit it into the document, but I really wanted to, you know, get whatever other input the commission wanted to provide, you know, before we did that.
Joseph or Jesse, do you have any input?
I don't know.
Okay, I'll.
So, Jerry, I wasn't clear on Exhibit G where that was going in the document.
I thought it was going in the introduction.
Yeah,
the introduction was also rewritten in Exhibit H.
Right. I think the idea was that whatever we would put in there as the vision would precede the text that was in the existing housing element introduction.
Exhibit G, is the first paragraph just an introduction, or is that part of the vision statement?
That is the vision statement that should be in the introduction.
The first paragraph seemed different, and so I wasn't sure if that was part of it or just an introduction to what you were saying in the next paragraph.
I think some of it was to try and tie it in to the Plan Morro Bay, since this is kind of a subset of Plan Morro Bay, but to remind us of where we started in the whole general plan.
Okay.
So that given that Plan Morro Bay vision is describing where we want to be in 20 years, that the housing element is specifically focusing in on this kind of community we want to be relative to the housing needs in the community.
Right, okay.
The kinds of jobs and all. So maybe we don't need it, but it's just a way to tie the two in together. And then I tried to pull the page references. The interesting thing was that the vision plan and Plan Morro Bay ended up like in section 2 instead of right at the beginning of Plan Morro Bay. So I don't know quite how that gets dealt with, but.
Well, and also the housing element is going to be a final document maybe before.
Right.
The general plan and the others. So that
you want it to be able to stand by itself.
Right.
But restating what is going to come in Plan Morro Bay or came before is probably a good way to tie them together.
Right.
I thought.
Okay.
Okay, is that clear, Nancy?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. Great. Okay, we don't need a motion or anything on this, do we, Scott? We just need, a quorum for.
Well, I mean, I think you've given us the direction. Oops, I think you've given us direction, so I think we're okay. I think we can figure out, you know, what to do with it. So.
Okay. Okay. And, great.
And we also have Amy with us now. She's.
Hi. Thanks.
Okay. Welcome, Amy.
Wasn't a panelist at first. There. Appreciate
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I had to get you up there. And...
Okay. So moving on, we've got we were starting in the goals and policies and implementations and actions, implementation actions. You know, I've got that on 3-117 on my printout. One of the things I had a little problem with just the organization of it. It seemed to follow through on it. We were having to bounce back and forth between pages. Maybe that this section, I was thinking maybe this section could be handled either in a chart or a table like we did the previous section, or at least put the implementation actions below the policies that they support. It seems we've got the goals, and then we've got a list of the policies, and then we have a list of the implementations on 3 or 4 pages later, or two pages later. So, you know, like maybe we should have the implementation actions under, like, for policy H1.1, we should have, that's under the goals. So maybe we should have the implementations either under that or have it listed in a table where we can see it all across and you can cross-reference it rather than flipping pages back and forth. Did anybody else have a problem with that?
Jerry, I think the intent is kind of a shorthand, quick look at goals, policies, and then if you're so engaged that you can't stop reading, then you get into the implementation. But you wouldn't get a shorthand view at the goals and policies if you put all the implementation actions under each policy. They're restated before the implementation, but I think if I see what you're saying, to blend them all in, and I think for reading comprehension that would work better, but I think you'd lose the quick look.
Okay, just to me it seemed like the implementation is actually the meat. You know, the goals and the policies are overarching, but the implementation seems to be the hammer and nails that make it work. So that was my thoughts. If nobody else has a problem with it, then...
Jerry, I think you did what I did and looked at the first housing element that was printed out, the first draft of it, and then there was a second draft because the page numbers are a little different. And I would say in the second draft, the way it's formatted, it's a little different, and to me, it flowed better. So okay, that might help. It still separates them, so you have the policies all listed, but somehow it seems better to me that way. And then you have the implementations, but they do relate to each of these action items. So
okay, it seems to me just like we should either have all the goals listed, mm-hmm, then all the policies listed, and then the implementations listed. Or we should have the goals, policies, and implementation for each item listed together. It just seemed awkward to me.
Right.
So to have two of one and then one, you know, your supporting document or your supporting actions further mm-hmm back. But if nobody else had a problem with that, it just must be the way I organize data.
Yeah. It does have the six goals listed right at the beginning. And then it goes through each individual goal with the policies and then the implementation. So,
if I can jump in here for a second. Sure. Jerry, are you suggesting we add a table in addition to what's here or instead of?
That's debatable. I was thinking instead of, but, as an addition to it, as an addendum to it, it may make it clearer as a table in the back like they do building codes.
Right, I can see what you're saying, and it doesn't, I don't read it that way necessarily, but I mean, if you do, maybe other people would also, so maybe a table would be helpful for others as it would be for you.
Okay, Amy, what are your thoughts on this?
I was just going to clarify actually what Susan was saying, that the goals that are listed together are the regional compact goals. They're different than the city, the local goals. All I would say, and I don't know if Scott wants to chime in, is that this is the format of all the other elements of the general plan. So there might be a consideration there about changing one of them.
Yeah, hey, Scott, you have any thoughts?
That is what I was going to say. Now, this is the format of the general plan. And part of that format was driven by our interactions with Coastal Commission staff and their input on the LCP portion of that. And so this would changing this to a different format would deviate from that. It wouldn't look the same. But overall, you have the whole entire general plan, and this would be one element that now looks different than the others, which I think could add confusion potentially.
Okay. Would a table clarify it or just cause more confusion? A table at the end just restates all of this.
So we do have a table at the end in the rest of the general plan, so I think this would be included in that once this is finalized.
Yeah, I was going to say, I flipped through to that, and it was a great table. You have the element, the action, type of action, whose responsibility. Remember that sort of flow chart at the very end. So if this gets that little pattern to it, too, I think that would fill in for what Jerry's looking for.
Okay, well, if it's there, it wasn't in my copy. I must have got a previous copy.
This is in the general plan.
It's in the general plan.
Yeah.
The general plan has the table at the back that has all of this in it, sort of condensed in one place to go look at it, which is really handy when you're looking at an entire general plan. And I think what Amy was saying is, this being an element of the general plan would be something we would put into the table.
Okay. Just maybe that would be sufficient. It seems like this bothered me more than anybody else. So I'll, if it's listed as a table in general plan, then I think that would be sufficient. Does anybody else have any overall comments before we get into the individual goals and policies? Okay. Then let's move into goal H1 and policy H1.1 and policy H1.2. Any issues on those items?
Can I just go back real quick on that same page right before there where we're looking at these regional policies? One of them, and we haven't seen the vacation rental ordinance yet, or at least hasn't been made public to my knowledge. R6 on 3.125 says encourage rental units to be prioritized for long-term residents rather than short-term users or vacation rentals. That doesn't conflict with our Coastal Commission wanting to have inexpensive short-term occupancy. They're okay with that regional statement applying to us?
Well, it does say encourage. I think they'll want to take a look at it, and they may have an opinion. It is at the policy level, so there's no specific actions that address that in the housing element. And I think, like we talked about before, the short-term rental specific actions are in other parts of the general plan. So I don't know.
Okay.
Scott, we worked with all the jurisdictions on this, so it was something that was agreed upon by all the coastal jurisdictions, but we'll have to see what coastal says.
Okay.
I mean, I think ultimately, where that's going to be decided is in the actual ordinance that we bring forward, to amend the zoning code to, include the vacation rental ordinance.
Okay. So that's H1. And so then we've got policy from H1.3 to H1.7. Does anybody have any comments on those policies?
I guess one of the things I was interested in is H1.4, the variable density mixed income planned unit developments. Are we really looking to have some of these larger parcels be mixed units, or are we looking for them to be attacking the low and lower income level problems that we have? Is that, I guess what I'm saying is that looks like it's some of it could be low income as opposed to using some of those parcels to attack the larger problem that we have. Or is it conveniently nebulous the way it's written there?
I think it is nebulous to some extent, but I think successful projects mixed income. So you don't put all of one income group in one spot. You intersperse them throughout the community.
I agree with what Nancy said there. I'd rather see more mixture. So rather than say have 10% low income, make it be 20% or whatever parameters we use. But I like the idea of mixing varying levels of family types, income levels, retirement and young kids, all, you know, if that's the kind of place people want to live, that they will choose that. So I'd almost like to see this one be even stronger. Because I think we do have, you know, with ADUs and with a lot of the housing that we have approved, we have created these sort of one identity kinds of housing. And so I like this idea of a more of a mixed kind of housing, mixed community.
I don't know if we're done talking about that one, but I want to talk about H1.6 when we're done, Jerry.
Okay. Okay, well, let's move on to H1.6. Okay, just a second. Susan, so do you see, or Susan or Michael, do you have any verbiage you want to change? Or is...
No, I just think traditionally when I see mixed income, it's going to be 1% low income and 99% is going to be up there. Well, we're dealing with mixed income. It's mixed.
Yeah, you know? According to the codes, we're at like 10% at least is, you know, quote unquote affordable. And that's even higher in the smaller units. So if you're under 10, you're still required to put one unit in. So I think we're getting our mixes in there, and then for increased density, we're stating that the increased density should prioritize low income or affordable housing. I think we've got that stated several places in here. So is there anything specific you'd like to change or to add, either Susan or Michael? Okay, well, then let's move on. Jesse, you wanted, you got 1.6 you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, 1.6, there's the last sentence kind of sits wrong with me, talking about higher density with lower impact. So, I mean, I feel it's a bit disingenuous. We know that the higher density is going to impact these neighborhoods significantly with parking issues. And I just feel it's a disingenuous to say it that way. So, I don't know.
Maybe we can change that to something with to minimize impact or
to something. Minimize impact or something like that. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, because it all has an impact.
Everything does.
Yeah,
it does. I think the point behind that is really to differentiate it from like a high density housing project. You can create density by having these, you know, tiny homes and micro homes in existing neighborhoods, where they don't have as much of an impact, say, necessarily as putting in a high-density development in one location. I think that's kind of what this is supposed to be saying.
Yeah, I got that. But in those types of situations where we're, you know, talking about new development, you would be considering parking from the get. You know, here we're trying to, you know, squeeze a round peg into a square hole. And I'm with it. You know, I mean, I know we need the housing. But just higher density with minimized impact to existing neighborhoods is more real.
Well, also with the ADUs, we're actually, they can put the ADUs where the parking is now and not have to replace parking. So we're not minimizing impact at that point, especially when we have narrow streets and parking only on one side of the street.
Well, we're definitely not lowering the impact. I think that's what I was getting at. We're definitely impacting these neighborhoods, and I you know, I'm the first one to jump on the boat and saying, hey, we need to do this. We need the housing. But I just, like I say, I would prefer to see a different word in there. So that's just my take.
With maybe change it to minimal?
However we can agree on it.
to manage the impact.
Okay.
I like sure. Manage. Yeah.
I can live with manage.
You good with that, Jesse? Okay.
I can live with that.
Okay, then... I've got an issue with 1.7. The way we have our zoning now, which is, you know, admittedly a hodgepodge, the new plan actually eliminates some of the overlay districts that are separating commercial and residential that allow a mixed use. And so correct me if I'm wrong, but some of those are going to be in the new plan. Some of those overlays are going to be eliminated, and then that zone for those areas are going to be strictly commercial. So therefore, the housing would only be allowed to have one caretaker unit on it rather than be a mixed-use commercial S4 district. Am I reading that wrong, Scott?
Oops. 1.7.
If I can comment on that just real quick, Scott, in the meantime. The live-work unit, as it's redefined in the new residential code and the new building code, it really talks a lot about this specific issue. And you can basically put a house anywhere. You can put it on top of a fireworks factory if you wanted to, pretty much.
I mean, we have in the, you know, in the draft general plan and zoning code, we have policies for mixed use in most of our commercial areas. I think the one exception, we had it on there for a while. And then we removed it from like a shopping center areas, I think that's correct. But everywhere else, it allows us.
Scott, we're getting a lot of feedback.
Is not talking, should mute their microphone.
Somebody probably has a device open.
Okay, sounds like it's fixed.
Think about it. Okay, yeah, no, you're good. So what I didn't want to get into is I didn't want to have our. So the feedback I don't think is coming from me, but. I didn't want to get into where we're reducing the ability to put residential into the commercial, you know, into the where it's allowed now, and then it wouldn't be allowed in the future. So I think we're trying to expand the areas where we can put residential in rather than minimize it. So as long as that's not pushing us towards that, then I'm okay with it.
We actually expanded the mixed use, areas where they could be. We have transitional mixed use in the draft, and then we have mixed use overlay in it as well that allows for mixed use in most of our commercial areas now, and not just as a caretaker, you know, security unit.
Okay. Okay. Good.
Hey, Jerry.
Yes.
With respect to policy H1.6 and the accessory dwelling units. Does anybody besides me feel that it would be a good idea to put something in here explicitly about the accessory dwelling units not being available for short-term rentals to maintain the integrity of this document?
We don't have to do that. The state's already made that decision for us.
That it clearly will not be available for vacation rentals?
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Ken?
One thing about H17, the way it's written, it says promote a policy of mixed uses. So, you know, if we find that in the execution of the plan, we've got some of those restrictions, because I'm thinking, my recollection is like Scott, we expanded the opportunities for mixed use. So if we see the actual execution is in conflict with the policy, we can potentially do something down the line. Can we do that, Scott, or Amy?
Absolutely. You'll be, it's, you know, kind of interesting. I mean, we thought we would be done with the general plan, everything by now. We're not, obviously. So the housing element's going to be in front of it. So as we get through the housing element and we start bringing the general plan back in front of you and for review, and as you see issues related to that, you can certainly bring them up in relation to the housing element and or zoning code. So, sure.
Okay. So everybody good with H1? Any other changes or comments? Okay. So then moving on to the H1 implementation actions, we've got H1 1.1 or something. So, and then – So H1.1.1 and then H1.1.2. Anybody have any issues with those items?
I had a thought, and this may be off base here, and Scott, tell me if I'm out of line and bringing it up right now, but it seems to me the majority of the complaints we get from the general public when it comes to height exceptions is, well, when we have projects, it's height exceptions and allowing these projects to bust it. So I was wondering if we could maybe think about talking about requiring a 4-1 vote instead of a 3-2 vote to approve these projects.
So some of that's problematic because with the way the state law has changed, affordable housing projects, especially all affordable housing projects, are allowed to ask for up to four exceptions. And honestly, it almost makes them by right. If they can prove that it's necessary to make the project pencil out, you know, from a getting it constructed standpoint. So I don't know that that's maybe the best way to go about that. If it makes, you know, votes less likely to follow that, then the chances of ending up in an appeal process or in litigation, it would be expanded potentially.
Just a thought.
I said, you know, also we've come to the point where there's, you know, we usually get at least a 4-1 vote on most of these items anyway. So I'm not sure. I'm trying to remember how many items that came before us that it would have made a difference on that, Jesse.
Oh, I think we're going to be the exception. I think we get along exceptionally well. I'm kind of yeah. looking forward to, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years from now when we may get a knucklehead or two on here. So anyway, that was just my thoughts.
Okay, then moving on to H1.1.3. Anybody have any comments on that?
I'm sorry. I guess the 1.1.2. The one thing that concerned me there was allow at the bottom. It says allow greater density bonuses when needed, and that seemed to me to be who decides when the need is when the developer is that a developer oriented comment there? It just seemed to be anybody could say it's needed. You know,
that's a good point.
I think it's for affordable housing. I would think it's to do with the State Assembly Bill 1763, where you meet certain criteria and you earn density bonus. And they've increased the density bonus to an extent where I think previously we were talking about better defining the criteria that a developer had to go through to earn a higher density bonus, but that may have been taken care of for us through Assembly Bill 1763.
So
what about changing it to say when requested?
I thought the question was who's requesting it.
Right.
Should be the developer or the applicant.
Or upon request.
Yeah, I mean, there's in the current ordinance, there's criteria that allows you to go above the what was previously the 1763, a 35%, you know, maximum density bonus. And we just didn't have any parameters to put in place to, you know, and one of the things we're going to do with our SB2 grant funding was to put some parameters in place so to develop those so you had criteria to follow when somebody asked for them, because it's probably going to be somewhat rare that you're going to get, you know, a whole bunch of all affordable housing projects like the HouseLow project that you saw a few meetings ago. It's more likely that you'll get, you know, projects that have several, you know, affordable housing units in it and several market rate units. And so it's those parameters kind of in there that, you know, where we needed some of the guidance. And our current ordinance gets you to the point where you can get up to 35 or over 35. It just says you can ask for more. It doesn't, and beyond that, doesn't say anything. And I think that's what this policy was trying to get at was, and kind of is reflective in what we're going to be doing with SB2 grant funding, is to kind of put those parameters in place so you know, what we would want. And that's probably related to the affordable levels. We want some extremely low income units in there and some very low, like a certain amount of them in order to qualify for that over the 35 between that and what would otherwise be allowed to be, if you had a full affordable housing project, would be 80% density bonus under 1763. So,
I think so, one more thing about this program or this implementation action. I think this is really focused on projects where smaller parcels are being consolidated into a larger site. So I think the reason it said when needed is when needed in order to make that project work in terms of the lot consolidation.
So because it's
perhaps the language could be better.
Because it's following up the paragraph above, it's meant to be self-reflective on specifically the affordable income. You know, I like when you said allow greater density bonuses when needed to fulfill the low and extremely low and whatever we're using for affordable, as Ms. Winholtz was talking about, those goals.
Well, maybe if we just eliminate the when needed.
Well, then it seems automatic.
Density bonuses, I mean, as we increase density, we would, you know, basically lower the prices of the rentals or the housing, you know, by market, you know, could be smaller units and more of them. So, I mean, that would almost take care of itself, I would think.
We have a qualifier in the sentence up above.
Yeah, that's true.
The following incentives will be considered when required for affordable housing development feasibility on a project-by-project basis.
Yeah, the bullets, even if they seem like they're automatic, the considered takes away the automatic and means that it is subject to review.
And ties to feasibility.
Yeah. Okay.
I think if we just, you know, maybe when, you know, eliminate the when needed or leave it as it stands, which way do you want to go, Michael?
I think everything's based on when demonstrated kind of aspect to it. But I would almost like to get rid of when needed. That I think allow greater density bonuses would be considered is implied by the upper paragraph as the operation.
And it would also be more consistent with the other bullet points.
Yeah.
None of those are qualified.
Makes sense to me.
Okay. Yeah, we'll just strike when needed. We got three nods on that one at least.
Hey Jerry, I have a question.
Sure.
Again, on that H1.1.5, I guess it's the fourth bullet point where it says the city will consider enforcing minimum residential density requirements for R3, R4, and MCR. I didn't understand what the significance of that was. Why wouldn't we consider that? Is that my point? I mean, what does it say? What is that? I didn't understand.
Where are you, Joseph? Saying. I'm sorry.
I'm on page 129, the fourth bullet point. The city will consider enforcing minimum residential density requirements.
Yeah, is that one H1.1.2 or?
It's H1.1.5.
Okay, we haven't got there yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm out to lunch then. I'm sorry.
No, you're just faster than the rest of us.
Okay.
Okay, so we're moving on to H1.1.3 now. Okay. Any issues with that? Okay, then next action item is H1.1.4. Okay, and the next one's yours, Joseph, H1.1.5.
Right, so that fifth bullet point, where the city will consider enforcing the minimum residential density. I didn't understand what that statement was trying to say. I mean, I suppose I could guess at it, but I think we could do well to kind of expand on what we divine to be the meaning of that.
Yeah, I had that circle too. I had that highlighted. Also, to
we have for each one of the land use classifications, we have density ranges for them, and so what it says is, hey, you can't build below that. So if somebody came in and wanted, had an R3 piece of property and wanted to put one single family house on it, we'd say, no, thanks. You need to actually meet the density requirements for R3, which is a, you know, medium, you know, density residential standard, like 7 to 15 units per acre or something like that.
Would we just want to get rid of consider and say the city will enforce minimum residential?
Exactly.
That's my point.
Constraints that, so if there's an ESHA on the site, or if there's a heritage tree on the site, or if there's an extreme slope and you can't do it, or if the site is long and narrow and you can't get a driveway back to multiple units. So our code currently has an exception where if it's not possible to build more units, then you can build fewer units. And so I think that's the consider part, at least in my mind.
Couldn't they do a zone change?
So what about just, if feasible in there as a qualifier?
Well, I mean, feasible, it sounds like it might be feasible to the developer or the applicant.
Okay. Jerry, my notion was just to make clear to anyone reading this, particularly developers, that the expectation going into the process is that we will require at least the minimum density.
What if we added the word existing where it says consider enforcing existing minimum residential density requirements? Would that be more clear?
I would say get rid of consider. The city will enforce minimum residential density requirements unless there are other constraints. So that allows you to look at ESHAs, look at the size of the lot. So you're just saying, yes, this is what we're going to do, but we understand that there could be other constraints that we have to look at.
Well, let me ask a question to Scott here, if you don't mind, or sure. Sorry, Nancy. Couldn't they apply for a zone change on an R3 where we had ESHA problems? And then that would go before the Planning Commission, right?
That kind of seems like cruel and unusual punishment. But we already own a high-density site. It can't be developed to the same density, and now we're going to make them do a rezone to do a lower density when our current zoning code would allow it.
So, Nancy, don't we calculate this on developable area? You know, we have slope standards. ESHAs wouldn't be considered into the developable, bubble or developable envelope.
The units per acre is just units per acre. It doesn't say units per developable acre or units per usable acre. All of that goes into the review when you discover certain things about a site that causes it to not be developed, ability to develop to its highest density.
Okay.
Can we say, though, enforce except in unusual site-specific circumstances? So that it looks like the dominant position will be to enforce, with the, as opposed to the dominant position might be to enforce. You know,
right.
Yeah, I think we could probably live with something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is that clear enough for you, Scott?
I think so. Everybody good? Amy, Nancy?
Yeah.
No, sorry, I didn't really hear what the final recommendation was.
I think it was the city will enforce minimum residential density requirements for R3, R4, and MRC zoning districts, except in consideration of site-specific extraordinary conditions.
Or constraints.
Right. Probably good, yeah.
Okay. Everybody good with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
On the next bullet, what's supportive housing?
Supportive housing is defined in state code. It is housing with other services provided on site for the people who live there. So it can be rehab or for folks who have disabilities. It's somewhat broad, but that's what it is.
So are we talking about rehab centers?
That could be part of it.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's permanent. It's not transitional housing is usually where somebody is there for a short amount of time.
Okay. Did you have an issue with that, Jesse? Or?
No, I didn't know if this was talking about convalescent homes or if this was talking about halfway houses. I wasn't quite sure. Yeah.
It encompasses more than one thing. The fact that there are supportive services on site in addition to it being a unit or a place where someone can live is the main part of the definition, and it can apply to various groups.
Okay. Moving on to H1.1.7 on the implementation action.
Okay, can I go back? I'm sorry. I was going page by page here. So on 3-130, where it says allow manufactured homes in the same way single family homes are allowed, that's only in regard to the support housing that's up above, right?
No, that's a separate zoning requirement just related to manufactured homes.
So that means in specifically any zone?
Any zone that allows residential.
We can't prohibit them.
Okay, interesting.
It's one manufactured home, it's not a park. So, yeah.
Does they have a density bonus?
It does.
Right. I mean, it's treated the same way as a single family residence would be.
Sorry, I was being snarky. I apologize.
Okay, so I think we're at 1.1.7. And my page numbers are off from you guys', so you're going to have to go along with me. And then moving on to 1.1.8. The issues. Okay, 1.1.9. Then moving on to 1.1.10.
This I've got a note here. I've got to see what I was thinking about here.
Yeah, I've got some underlining here too. So go, Michael.
We'll consider reduction or deferral of typically required improvements, and I understand deferral. But I'm not sure about reduction, because it seems to be that these are the things that are most needed in the high-density areas, you know, to improve the sidewalks, to improve the curbs that they're talking about, you know, the utility infrastructure. Those are the exact things that the higher densities are going to impact. That so I could understand the deferral, but the reduction kind of spooked me a bit on that one. And I was a little surprised that we would reduce that. You know, on the Haslow, we deferred, if I'm not mistaken. But I was a little, if I would say, well, we can't make this project, high-density project, work, it's like we were talking about before, mitigate the impacts. I can't make this work with the underground utilities, or I can't make this work without the curb and gutter, or, you know, I just was wondering, is that going to come back to bite us at some point down the line? Is somebody going to ask for a reduction because it's an implementation action?
Well, it's a consideration is all it says. We can consider it and say no.
I like that there, actually.
I think the idea would be then if they're making some request to not do something they're supposed to do, they're going to have to provide the justification, meaning do the math, and prove it to us. If they don't prove it to us, then the answer would be no.
You know, if there was a lot with a, you know, extremely long front yard, and they had to, you know, improve 250 linear feet of sidewalk, and you just killed the project. I mean, I would like the ability to defer that if possible. I mean, if that was a deal killer.
Yeah, we also had, that Haslow project also was required to put in a, to replace that sewer main there, which is not cheap to begin with either, and they were able to do that. So, you know, I think we have a qualifier in there. I had underlined that same phrase too, Michael, but the qualifier there is to avoid being prohibitive. So I think that's where Scott says they have to prove justify it.
Well, what I like in that sentence is that it's for affordable housing developments. This isn't for, you know, McMansion on ag land. So, I mean, I think that helps.
Okay.
And I think we talked with the state about this one. I don't remember if the language changed based on their review, but I think they liked the fact that there was something in there to potentially address any constraints that are identified related to the fees.
Okay, Michael, what's your feeling?
Well, we've got the consider in there. I'm just concerned that when I see some of these larger lots, if we have the large lot on North Main, that's close to the Delmar School. Is that right? Yeah, the school in North Bay. You know, if they would say, well, I don't want to put in the sidewalk, well, that's critical for access to the school. Or you know, I think it's I just, especially if it's the Haslow thing, because it was all low income, was interesting. But if we have one of these ones where 10% of the project's affordable and they ask for reductions, I'll let the future planning commissioners worry about that, I guess. It says consider, so.
Okay. So then moving, we'll leave it the way it is, and then moving forward to the next item, H1.1.11. Anybody have any comments or issues?
Okay. Go ahead, Michael.
Okay. I was going to say, I like the idea of rounding up fractions on these things. Not looking at 0.49, that becomes the next number when we talk about that.
I wondered why we can't say it's 20% instead of 10% that we're providing in total number of units that would be considered affordable.
I wonder if that would drive developers away.
It would. That's probably the profit margin.
Well, or you get a different type of developer, or we figure out different ways to help them make up that difference.
Okay.
What is our real commitment to providing, you know, do we only provide affordable housing if, you know, Haslow comes in and says, we'll build a whole thing. You get your 31, 32 units here. I don't know.
So if you, you know, Susan, if you're putting in 10 units, and you require somebody to do under market or actually under cost housing for two of those 10 units, you're not going to get those 10 units built. You're not going to get those two units. You're not going to get the other eight units at market rate. So, you know, somebody would rather, you know, they would move to Atascadero or move to Los Osos or move to the county, and the housing would get built there. So I think we need to be concerned. You know, that's my concern with that.
Amy, do you know if anybody else, any of the cities locally, have a number that's more an inclusionary number that's more than 10%?
I don't know off the top of my head about the local comparison or the regional comparison. I just was on a previous planning commission meeting in a different LA County jurisdiction, and we talked about this exact issue. Because they're considering, they don't have an inclusionary ordinance yet, but they have a 3,000% increase in their RENA, and they're probably going to adopt one. And they are considering 20%. And I have another client in Ventura County. They're considering increasing to 20%. So it's definitely being discussed a lot more. I think the development community points are very valid as well, based on my understanding. So it's definitely a decision point. And I'm happy to look into the local and regional comparison as well.
Can we tie this to adjacent communities, the county and the adjacent communities? Because one of the things is being, the higher we get that number, the more expensive the market rate housings are going to go. So if we have a 20% inclusionary rate, that means instead of, just for instance, instead of somebody selling a market rate house for $550, they're going to have to sell that market rate house for $650. So therefore, we're driving the moderate prices up to make it a profitable situation for people to take the risk to develop. So,
hey, Jerry?
Yeah.
Does that disparity going from 10% to 20%, that probably gets more acute, more of a profit drain as you're dealing with smaller projects, meaning a developer might be, you know, more attuned to accepting 20% if he was building 50 units and less attuned if he was building 10. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and we have mostly small lot developments, whereas the larger developments, you can take the density bonus of including those extra, you know, the lower cost and get more market rate units or get more lower cost units into the site as by accepting some of the density bonuses that you can't handle on the smaller sites.
Yeah.
Well, and Scott can speak to this more than I can, but I mean, you know, this city's been around a while. So, I mean, a lot of the more easily buildable lots are probably built out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I imagine we're dealing with a lot of lots, and Scott, correct me if I'm wrong, that are probably tough builds.
I mean, that's correct. And that's why you have policy in here also that you saw that, you know, that talks about, you know, putting these small lots together so you can get more units. It's for that reason that Commissioner Barone just mentioned. We have a lot of small lots, and it's difficult to do those types of things, and it makes it easier the larger the lot that you have versus the small lots that we have in town. So that is an issue. I mean, I guess I could say this. If there's interest in the commission for us to do this, we'd be happy to, as Amy said, take a look at our comparators around here and see what they're doing, and we can report back to the city council when we move this forward.
I'm still a little concerned. It looks to me like the way I read this right now, 4 units, none. 5 units, 1. 6 units, 1. 15 units, 1. 19 units, 1. Do I have to get to 20 to get 10% to get 2? You know, and it seems like it's 10%, but 10% really means up to, you know, 19%.
I think it's a combination of that.
20.
And in lieu fees, and our ordinance, Chapter 1750, has a lot of language in there to encourage additional density bonus for the income levels that you're putting those units at. I mean,
it just seems like if you cobble together enough space, you can have 19 units and only have to provide 1.
But if we said 15%?
Or if you said 0 to 4, none, 5 to 10, 1, 11 to 15, 1, you know, whatever, put an index in there rather than a percentage.
But as I read this, this is just saying that the city will continue to implement the existing policy. The next section is talking about a strategy to try to encourage people to actually build their affordable housing instead of paying the in-lieu fee by increasing the in-lieu fee and then also expanding the types of developments that are subject to inclusionary housing fees to include single-family homes. So it seems like the next section is where if you want to tweak with, you know, we've got some grant funding to work on changes to this section. It seems like the next section, implementation section, is where you want to make those changes.
Yeah, why don't we look at that then? On the next action item is what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, this also ties into the development fee for houses over 2,000 square feet. So let's consider the what Michael was saying. How would we coalesce those the inclusionary housing set points in here.
Well, the thing I had written down here is, since we're counting in the policies on ADUs to become more prevalent, if you build a single-family home of a certain size and you don't build an ADU, should you have to pay an in-lieu fee?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then we've lost that opportunity for a low-income unit, and we're down-zoning the density.
And I'll say, you know, if you're I would be hard pressed to explain the difference between someone building a multi-unit structure and someone building a house, in terms of both individuals are necessarily buying into this housing element and the value of providing affordable housing to the community. I don't see where the distinction as to what you're building justifies your need to contribute to that inclusionary housing. Also, I have one. I'm sorry. I have one other question. You know, I suspect that admittedly we don't have a lot of developers coming to Morro Bay, but of the groups that do or have in the past, that probably the in-lieu fee has been much more popular than building the actual units. Is that correct?
And I think that's why this section's written the way it is, to increase the in-lieu fee and broaden what it's applicable to try to encourage people to actually provide the units. But it's tough because they're deed restricted units for a minimum of 30 years. That's a long, long commitment versus the short-term pain of paying some in-lieu fees up front.
Right,
so you could do both. You could increase the fees and you could increase the applicability of the inclusion increased percentage.
So can Nancy or Amy, are there any communities that actually take over the administration of these low-cost housing in the community development department?
Yes.
Because this is part of the problem too, is the administration. If you've got a small, if you've got a small development, and I'm kind of speaking, you know, from my, you know, my personal knowledge here, and you're doing between the 5 and the 10 units, you've got to administrate this whole low-cost housing for 30 years for one unit. It's quite a burden.
It's an annual certification. Most management companies will handle it. It's just an annual certification of rental income verification.
The conditioning on these do require them to report to us.
Right.
And we have to agree with the qualification process. I mean, we're doing that for Morro Mist right now.
So is there any way that could be brought into the community development to because, you know, one personal developer handling 6 or 7 units is not going to have the staff, you know. They're probably handling the rentals themselves rather than running through a rental agency.
Yeah, but I think a developer is typically going to construct and walk away. They're going to sell to an investor. They're not really going to manage typically a 30-year, 40-year, 50-year type plan. You know, they're going to come in, knock it out, and get out of there.
And I wasn't arguing that there was no place for in-lieu fees. I'm just arguing that there's such a disparity so that it seems like an obvious justification as to why the in-lieu fees have got to be increased substantially because the developers are always opting for the other choice, which means it's undervalued.
Well, and we literally want both. When the development comes in, we want the affordable housing units, and we also need to have some source of housing funds to assist with affordable housing projects. And in fact, when they're tax credit projects, us giving them money has them score higher in their tax credit applications. So, I mean, there's a lot that goes into that. And it also, you need, you know, money to do things like, you know, pay for the housing element that we're working on right now. So
Scott, is there any, you know, kind of moving on to the ADU that was brought up? I think Jesse brought it up. Is there any methodology in here for the if you include an ADU in a larger home to get a deferment on the on these development fees so that it would encourage an ADU, so you would have the housing by design, you'd have the low cost housing by design rather than by fiat or by management. See, right now I don't see.
What I heard Mr. Lucas saying was that it would actually be an in lieu fee that would be applied if an ADU wasn't built. Is that what you said?
You could do both.
it doesn't read that way to me. It reads that if you build a larger house, whether you supply an ADU or not, you're going to be charged. You know, you're going to be charged a development fee.
Yeah. So we didn't talk about ADUs when we wrote that language. I think that's a really good thing to discuss. I guess I was just trying to clarify what was being suggested. Just in terms of fees related to ADUs, they're very low. I don't know that waiving fees associated with ADUs would be a solution that would help very much, I guess.
But you're charging a development fee for the main residence.
He's talking about the inclusionary housing fee, I believe.
Right.
So you're charging an inclusionary housing fee when they're already providing an ADU, they're already providing low cost, you know, affordable housing.
Perhaps if they were required to actually, if they were going to rent that as an affordable unit, then they could see the nexus there. They're not required to even rent the ADU if they're building an ADU, so you wouldn't know for sure if it's an affordable unit or even a unit that's on the market otherwise.
But right. It's going to be a unit by design. Even if they don't rent it, it's going to supply housing to a member of their family, or it's going to supply housing to actually, you know, a caretaker or something.
Oh, yeah, but Jerry, I could also imagine kind of an evasive ploy where the ADU is not a detached structure. It's attached to the house with an exterior door. You know,
a red herring.
I can imagine where it's just basically a ruse to avoid.
Yeah, but still, you've got, you know, the houses will be rolling over every 7 years. So you've got it built.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It could be built, and you know, and then somebody could roll it over the other way too. But you would have the structure, you would have the unit built. So it would, you know, eventually, you know, it would be used. I think.
If I could throw an opinion in here, I think we're going to get enough ADUs, folks that want accessory dwelling units and want that income, that rental income to supplement their mortgage, their extremely high mortgage, that I don't think that it's going to be necessary for us to implement some sort of an additional burden on a development.
But we're burdening, Jesse, I don't mean to argue, but we're burdening anybody who builds anything over 2,000 square feet, we're burdening them with another development fee.
The fee I'm in favor of. I mean, I get that if you're, you know, building a 2,000, you know, 4,000 square foot McMansion on whatever, yeah, that makes sense. But I mean, I just don't, maybe I misunderstood the, what was being, I'm sorry, the echoes, suggested here.
Well, I'm looking for some. Okay, the standard the average house size of square footage is about 2,400 square feet in California. So we're penalizing somebody that's building a standard size house or an average size house with a fee, even if they supply an ADU as a potential for low cost or affordable housing with the unit.
Right, but in the design phase there, they're just going to throw an additional wall up and call their wet bar a kitchen, and now it's an ADU, and I don't think we're getting what we intended to get. I think like Amy's, or I'm sorry, maybe Joe was saying that, you know, they're gonna, so it's going to be a ruse. It's going to be, okay, well, yeah, this is a ADU, wink, wink. You know, it's not really an ADU. It's just a big, gigantic house.
That's, you know, personally, that's not what I see. You know, I see people actually wanting to build the ADUs, you know, for their, you know, transition or kids or something, as they're trying to transition into their own families, or they're bringing their parents back into the household and stuff. You know, those, you know, it used to be when their ADUs were not as easily to build, you would actually build a game room and then turn that into a, you know, then you put your granny there, you know, and then give them a hot plate and stuff. But as the ADUs are become more acceptable in code wise, I'm seeing the people that have come to me for them actually are using them for their kids, their parents, their, you know, or renting them to a young professional who's just getting started in this area.
Right, right. No, I mean, I get what you're saying. I think what I'm saying is, I think it would be more likely that they would use it as a guest quarters rather than an actual rental unit. So, I mean, did we get what we were after? I don't think we would. I think we would get, you know, Joe Schmo homeowner over here who also has a guest quarters for their, you know, very frequent guests. We live in paradise, so I mean, people want to come here.
And I think the concept is to create changes in the inclusionary fee section to incentivize people to create reportable, affordable housing. So, for example, if we included houses that are over 2,000 square feet and they put in a JADU and an ADU and were willing to deed restrict it for some period of time, then I could see reducing or waiving the fee. But I think Jesse's right. I think it, you know, could look like meet all the requirements for an ADU, but it could be the pool house. So I think in our biggest problem with ADUs is nobody reports any income. So we believe that they're affordable by design, and we make some assumptions on how many of them actually would be affordable. But it would be really nice if we waived a fee for someone that they actually deed restricted and made a commitment.
I agree.
You're not, I don't. That would be really nice, but I don't see anybody would do the reporting on that. I think that would be a burden that nobody would take on.
Then they can pay the fee.
Right.
And I mean, you can also, I suspect you can make a case that anybody who does building or remodeling in Morro Bay ultimately leads to the increase in the average value of housing in Morro Bay. And that ultimately exacerbates the problem of affordable and low-cost housing. So irrespective of whether they build an accessory dwelling unit, just the mere fact that they're improving their house ultimately makes it more difficult for lower-income people to afford to live here. And then if you add to that people who are particularly well-heeled who come in to really remodel and build a much more expensive house, that drives the value of houses up as well.
I just see this as reducing the number of units that will be built.
But it sort of depends on the fee. you know, I mean, it matters what the amount is, right? You know, if it's $500, if you go to 2,500 square feet, then everybody's just going to pay the money and move on. You know, I mean, if it's $50,000, then maybe they consider building an ADU. I mean, the devil's in the details.
I'll bring up a personal aside. I've got a house that I was going to build, and you know, it's a 4,000 square foot house with an ADU attached, including the ADU, and the development fees are already $97,000 for permanent development. That's a lot of money for to put up front before financing to, you know, and then take the risk of whether it's going to be profitable or not. So the fees are already, the fees to build in Morro Bay are already extremely high. So anything we add to that is going to make the situation worse. So that's all, I'll leave it at that point. So where does anybody have any wording changes they would want to add to this implementation action item?
Well, back to the 10%, 20% thing. did we ever get past that?
Michael, do you have anything you want to add?
I just think we're going to end up with the same thing that happened the last 10 years. We're going to end up with no affordable housing.
Yeah.
And you know, if we don't have fees when you're not building it, there's not going to be any money for people like Haslow who do want to do it. And if you want to do it, I think you should have some benefit from doing it. You'll have an economic benefit from the rentals. But I think this is our chance to say something for the next 8 years when we're potentially going to have a huge influx of people migrating due to the pandemic fears and job migrations and things. And these are going to be more critical than ever, I think, in the future here. So I like the idea of stating a definitive thing rather than have a wiggly percentage with the, you know, percentage of unit thing. And in this, I'd like to see us have, maybe it's a floating scale, or, you know, one of my pet peeves is that when we say how many square feet is something, somebody has 600 square foot garage, supposedly. And, you know, instead of, is it a 2000 net occupiable square feet, or is it 2600 with your 600 square foot? So I would like to see it, whether it's 2000 or 2400 or whatever, be a gross square footage number, as opposed to one of these things where we've had some fantasy projects where, well, it's only a 2,000 square foot house, but it's got a 1,000 square foot or 1,500 square foot garage or something. You know, I don't think we should. I think it should be gross square footage. Maybe it's the fee slides that if you deed restricted, it's waived. And I do think we should have some numbers rather than percentages.
I agree with the numbers.
Okay, then we're going to have to change these numbers, because a 2,000 square foot gross area is going to be a 1,500 square foot house.
Right, right. I'm having trouble making it realistic. I just don't like the creep of square footage being there that we know they're going to use differently at some point.
I'll also remind you all that the draft zoning code doesn't require garages. So one thing is not like another, which is my point.
Right. So maybe we need to qualify this as living area. Or conditioned area. You know.
Well, to Michael's point,
I would implement it now, the way that it's written. I wouldn't assume that it's gross, as Commissioner Lucas was saying. I would assume that it's habitable.
Yeah.
Right, but we get these, I've seen a lot of 600 square foot ADUs with a 1,200 square foot workshop slash garage, like Commissioner Lucas is talking about. So I agree that a gross square footage number is probably more appropriate, and increasing the numbers to like 2,500, 2,650, something like that. And also, I liked his idea about the number rather than the percentage.
Okay, so we've got two. Susan, Joseph, where do you guys sit?
Yeah, I'm in favor of actual numbers, something to make it more definitive. I also wish we could just say something definitive about how we're increasing the in-lieu fees rather than leaving it unsaid.
Well, I think those fees are going to be determined by the city council. and will be changeable as it goes on.
What I meant was a suggestion somewhere in this that they should be increased if that's appropriate.
Okay. I think this calls for that study to happen.
All right.
Hey, Susan, where do you sit on this?
I like the idea of real numbers versus percentage. And I keep going back in my mind to something that Michael said when we were talking about all the vision stuff, which was that our housing stock is not only underutilized because of vacation homes and vacation rentals, but it's underutilized because we have so many relatively larger homes with one person living in them, including mine. I think mine is about 1,000 square feet, and it's just me, but there's plenty of room. So a 2,000 square foot house with maybe a couple in it who's retired seems like underutilized housing. So it doesn't hurt my feelings that it costs a whole lot to build a 4,000 square foot house unless you've got a 10-person family going into it. And yet I understand the frustration on the developer side of it. So again, if this housing element is supposed to be looking at affordability and how we make that happen, and unless we're serious about doing these in lieu fees so that we can help other projects, other developers who want to do that 20% inclusionary housing, then what's the point of any of it? So I don't see the point of requiring somebody to put in an ADU. Not everybody wants to be a landlord. Yes, there should be incentives for that. We should make it easier for, and I think the state is making it easier for people to do that. But to require that or you pay an extra fine, I'm not sure I would agree with that. But having higher in lieu fees in bigger projects where you have the opportunity to build affordable housing units, but you opt not to, yes, you should pay a fee for that. And if you're building a house that's bigger than whatever the average is, and you guys know those numbers in California, then yes, I think you pay some significant amount into these in lieu fees to help build affordable housing units elsewhere in town. So that's my thoughts.
Okay, what words do we put in?
I think the words are there. I'm not sure, at least in this H11.12, I'm not sure it's missing. Strongly encourage development applicants to provide affordable units versus payment of in-lieu fees, but the in-lieu fees, when approved, are collected and held in a trust fund. Maybe something, I mean, the council, again, will decide on what those fees are, and those will change over time. So I don't know. Who's got ideas on changing
more? So the policy inside of it, under the time frame section, says, hey, we're going to do this by December of 2022. And it says, hey, you're going to take a look at this and determine whether it's appropriate or not and what that looks like.
So that's good. Gives us a little more time to play with it.
I mean, my only point on bringing that up is, we don't have to make the decision right now. And quite frankly, the discussion that's happened right now, I don't see consensus on any of the things that you've spoken about so far. So I think that this probably does take a larger effort and one where we need to sit down in a group and work through what that looks like. And that, and this policy, the way that it's written right now, lets you do that later. If you're concerned about what that might be construed as later, though, then you need to come up with some language to put in here. So that's my take on where this is at. I think you have opportunity. This, again, these are implementation items. These are go-do things that the council will put in their goal-setting processes for future years for us to go work on.
Jerry, if I may, I know Michael and I agreed, but I don't know if I've got any more nods, maybe Joseph, but that sliding scale, I think we should definitely throw that in there if we can. That's something that may not change. You know,
on the fees. No, on the 1.1.11, then we go to under 5 units. You know, from 5 to 10 units is one. You know, 1 unit, and from 10 to 15 units is 2 units, and then 10% above that. Is that what we were talking about?
I don't know that we got to the actual numbers, but, you know, Susan brought it up about 20%, but then Michael, you know, asked about the sliding scale. So I think we ought to really nail that one down if we're going to nail anything down on this.
I just like rounding up. That's all. So as soon as you get to 10, and when you get to 11, it's 2, until you get to 20. When you get to 21, it's 3.
I would have been more in favor of 1 to 12. You do 1. At 13, you have to do 2. That's just kind of, you know, the number.
If there's something there, someone at a higher level pay grade than we have, since we're not getting anything right now, it's they can adjust the number. But if the number is not there, they can't adjust it. You know, so I would say.
Okay, and maybe let's bring Amy back in here. What you've heard the discussion on this. What do you suggest? What have other people done?
Yeah, so I like what I heard about the gross square footage, or making that more clear, whichever way you want to go with it, if it's putting in gross and increasing the square footage or saying living area. It sounds like it's not clear to you guys, and so it might not be clear when someone's actually administering it, if this is what ends up going in. And then I have been able to research a couple of the other jurisdictions. The county, they start at 20%. Rio Grande has a sliding, kind of more of the sliding scale model. It starts at 2 unit, you know, it's triggered by a two unit development, and then the percentage varies. That's all I've been able to find so far. Some of the stuff is more buried
okay.
than some of the other jurisdictions.
But don't we want to consider more general language in this section so that we can study it and then determine? Because it's a little bit of a balance between increasing the ILU fee and increasing the percentage of units that must be applied. Because we're trying to encourage people to create the units instead of just pay the fee. Or we have to increase the fee more. It seems like you could change the last sentence in H1.1.12 and say, consider scaling the fee for applicable projects. And that leaves us with by June 22 to come up with the changes that we need to make to that section of the zoning code.
Or I'm looking at, in that same paragraph, the city believes the inclusionary fees are reasonable. Well, that seems to really imply that they don't have to change. So I would take out the reasonable and say something about the city will evaluate or assess in some way, not, you know, instill the conclusion that things are fine the way they are, because if that were true, then you'd see some kind of equivalency between builders opting for fees versus builders opting to actually build.
But I think the rest of that sentence says that we believed when they were adopted that they were reasonable, but we're not getting the results that we thought we would.
Okay. All right. Okay. I see your point.
Okay. So let me try this. Let's on 1.1.12. Let's go ahead and increase the square footage to 2,500 square feet. And go for the gross.
Like
gross
it.
Area. That's kind of where I think we had consensus on that, or where it was headed. And then on the numbers for H1111, we're talking about, what is it, from 5 to 10 units, we're talking about 1 unit, 1 affordable unit. From 10 to 15, we're talking about, or 10 to 20, we're talking about 2 affordable units, or 10 to 15.
But so I think 1.1.11 is just saying that until we have another policy, we're implementing the current one. And those are the standards in the current one. So the next one is talking about making changes to the inclusionary fee section and changing what it applies to, how it's scaled, and the fee amount. So it does seem like we should broaden maybe the last sentence, because I think we're talking about scaling the applicability of the inclusionary housing fee to a larger group of projects.
And we're talking about 12 or 11 on that.
So if I can paraphrase, what I think I hear Nancy saying is we have another, 2 years until this is needed to be done.
Right.
We know we need to get it done. We'll get it done later.
Okay.
Well, and I'm saying put something general. We can't hold up the housing element. But I don't know that we're going to agree, and I don't know that we want to lock it in, because it's a balance between the fee increase and the applicability of how many affordable units you need to apply. So I think we want to be general on both and say we want to make it applicable to more projects and probably a higher scale, but that'll be determined by 2022.
Okay, so then we leave the wording, you're suggesting we leave the wording as is then?
I'm suggesting you change that last sentence. There's something like, consider scaling the applicability of the inclusionary housing fees to a greater number of projects, including increasing the amount of affordable housing to be created. Or the applicability, however you word that, whatever that chart is, that 1 to 5 or 1 to 12.
Okay.
To increase the percent of affordable housing that needs to be created.
Okay, that's a to-be-done item. On the H-111, though, would you include the – would you change it from a percentage to a – a set scale?
I think what Nancy was saying is that's just describing what's in place now, and then the action item is to actually go do the analysis and make a decision how it should be changed.
Okay.
Ambiguous, that's all. I think I can build 19 units and provide one with that, the way it's written.
No, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's supposed to be describing our current ordinance.
But it's not describing what we want to have happen. It's the current state of affairs.
Okay, so 11's dealing with the current. 12 is dealing with what is going to be the proposed.
Yes.
But we're talking about different numbers. We don't have... The proposed isn't dealing with the percentages.
I think what's confusing here is that the actual implementation is buried in the last is buried in there when it maybe should be front and center, first sentence. We are going to do this in June of 2022, and then explain what we're going to do.
Okay. So, who has a recommendation here?
I think Scott's kind of right. This is something we need to drill down on more. And if we have 2 years to do it, it may take that long. Because these are the implementation actions. So, yes, 10% is what we're currently doing, but we're talking about what we want to be doing for the next 8 years. And it sounds like what we're saying is we want some stronger actions to take, abilities, whether it's the in lieu fee or just to say you've got to do more than one unit if you're doing 19 units in a property. And I don't know how often that's going to happen. We don't have that many large lots here. But there's got to be ways to incentivize development that is appropriate to what people actually want here. And I, what I see in a lot of the development that's going on, I don't know who's buying those houses, except, again, wealthy people coming from out of the area who just want to escape big cities and want a second home. So,
well, but we could, you know, on accident, you know, create a housing element where we incentivize people to start tearing down these old 1936 houses, consolidate lots, and start doing these, you know, big projects. So,
well, we don't currently get applications for very large homes right now. It's just not happening. Even with
no, I mean,
not good. Good.
So,
yeah, I was talking about, you know, building 12 unit developments on three or four lots across, you know, a whole street front or something.
It was just a general statement that I was making. It's not something that we, you know, a while ago when I first started working here, we were seeing, this is 6 years ago, we did see applications like that, and it's one of the reasons we have residential design guidelines. But since then, we haven't received, you know, significant number of applications for large homes, and even the additions that most of the, you know, on the smaller homes that we're getting, the houses end up being under, you know, 2,200 square feet, a lot of times under 2,000. Wayne Colmer subdivision in Black Hills Village, none of those were over 2,000 square feet habitable. I think the biggest one was 1,800 square feet.
Okay, so we need to get a consensus here so we can move forward, guys.
Okay, so here's a suggestion. The second to the last sentence says, in addition, the city will update the development types subject to inclusionary requirements. We could add in and increase the amount of affordable housing to be provided versus paying an in lieu fee, and then pick up and also include single family projects of a gross square footage of 2,500 or more.
I could agree with that.
Hey, Jesse?
I concur.
Okay, Michael? Okay, I think we got agreement on that. And then back to H111. Are we going to go with set numbers on those, or are we still going to use the percentages?
We can't change it. That's the existing.
Okay. Okay. So we're good on that then. Let's move on to H1113. Anybody have any issues on those? Okay. The next page I have has H1114, 15, and 16. Any red flags on those?
The only thing on 1115 is in the, it goes into a list of things that says this is not intended to be an exhaustive list of incentives available to the applicant owner team. And it just, the note I put down is what's not in play. I mean, is everything in play? We know a lot of these things are becoming, you know, legislated, that we have no discretion over them. But I think it's interesting, and I like the idea that we're opening up the board, the game board, just for someone who's inventive to come in and think about these things. But on the other hand, it, you know, in the two implementation actions above there, we're talking about compatibility and design standards that are objective. And wow, what's not in play? I don't know. That's maybe more of a comment. Maybe it's too much of a Pandora's box to open, but I don't know what I would say to exclude if we would have an exclusionary statement. But that's just what struck me as I read it the first time.
I think what we'd exclude is Esha. Development into the Esha. Okay, so we leave that as it is, and we're into H1117, 18, and 19.
I'd like to talk about 119 when we get a chance.
I remember in 117, Betty Winholtz had a question about the conversion of older motels to residential use subject to discretionary review. And she wondered if that was planning commission or staff, I think that was her question. Maybe that could be clarified.
Discretionary review would be Planning Commission.
Thanks.
On going up to 1116 real quickly, when it says the city in lieu fee fund, do we have to put affordable housing or inclusionary housing in there to make sure people don't think they can raid the parking in lieu fee or something?
We could add that reference.
Okay. Okay, well, let's get H1119 then, Jesse.
As a point of clarity, I didn't really understand this sentence. As it's like two-thirds of the way down. As part of the activities included in the city's SB2 grant work, the city will explore additional ADU regulations that are less strict than is what is allowed under state law. I just don't understand what that means.
Okay, Scott?
So it would be allowing more flexibility than what is allowed per state law for ADUs, whether that's in terms of the square footage requirements, minimum sizes, things like that. State law is pretty permissive, but there are still standards in state law. So there's something that the community would want on that.
One of the things I was interested in there is where something like co-housing fit in there? You know, does that open that up to shared facilities within a single site with multiple units? So sharing kitchens or bath facilities, things like that?
Related to ADUs or?
Well, just the whole idea of if it's going to be more permissive, I wasn't sure what that meant either. You know, to me, the only thing that would be more permissive is the two dwellings start to share facilities in order to save money to create the project. So that made me think about co-housing, and I don't know if we addressed that anywhere in here specifically. And that's just the note that I wrote down to myself, you know, shared kitchen bath facilities. Could you start to have multiple small dwellings on a site then sharing a core, you know, cooking, bathing kind of place?
I think that's allowed with single room occupancy units, so that might, you know, it's not something that would be prohibited. I don't know that it would, you'd want to have it in the same category as a state ADU, because those are required to be, they have pretty specific requirements regarding facilities. But yeah, definitely in terms of some of the other unit types that are listed at the bottom, that makes sense.
Michael, I think if we get in, when we're getting into co-housing, I think we're getting into multifamily zones. I don't think those, you know, we want to allow those or open the Pandora's box of getting those into R1 zones.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, I like the way that there's so many of these things saying we're open to new ideas, but at the same time that they all have a threshold of the idea doesn't become acceptable. That was just I always try to game these things. What's the scenario, most radical scenario I can come up with that? And that's what that was. But if it's not a concern of others, and if it's got to come before a commission anyway, there's a slowdown process there that's not being done by right.
Yeah.
I think that what I didn't like about this couple sentences, the last couple sentences of that implementation action. So this will include exploration of allowing tiny homes or micro homes. So in the industry, and kind of speaking generally, and there's a kind of a misconception that tiny homes and micro homes built on chassis, I mean, with axles, for lack of a better term, you know, not a slab on grade or not a foundation type of permanent foundation type of dwelling. That's what the industry believes a tiny home is, and I don't want to see these things popping up in people's front yards, to be frank.
That's actually one of the things we'll be discussing.
Yeah. People, these things popping up in people's front yards?
Not necessarily front yards, but on properties, yes. That's the idea of this comment and between using some of the SB2 funding. It's one of the priority areas for HCD and releasing the grant funding.
Okay. I don't like it, but it sounds like I'm alone.
I'll say it again, the devil's in the details. It sort of depends on what that ends up looking like and what our policy ends up looking like, I think.
I'm always good with exploration. It's good to investigate. You may investigate and decide, you know, this just doesn't fit our town. Or you may decide this is a great idea, an inexpensive way to get somebody a really complete little unit. So I'm okay with exploration.
I know I'm going to sound like my old self on a soapbox here, but, you know, factory-built housing is factory-built housing. It's subject to Title 25. It's a different set of rules. There are rules for these, you know, factory-built houses, things built on chassis. Having the city jump into that arena just is a bad idea. And we should be building only Title 24 housing. And, you know, if people want to bring in a tiny home that's factory built, great. I just don't think we should be, and I know it sounds like we're going to get to this at a different time. I'm just going to be on my soapbox for a minute here. I don't think we should be allowing folks to factory build their own tiny home on a chassis. That's just my thing. So,
yeah. Okay. I'm a proponent of foundations myself. So, okay, moving on to item H120, H121, H122. I've just got an issue on the on H120, where we're trying to build a prototype plans for ADUs. We've got such a variety of lot sizes, and we are not the city was not developed as tracts, so I don't see a prototype house to develop a prototype plan from, other than the only way is a garage conversion. It's the only consistent feature we have on houses where you could do a prototype on.
This is getting into the tiny house issue, I think the city of SLO did it wrong, and I don't want to. I would not like to see that happen here.
I think there's a difference to me, because I have the same kind of note that Jerry did on mine. And to me, it's not so much it's the idea of a plan. It's almost like standards are one thing and a plan is something else. And I think when we determine what these things are going to be, I think we can put criteria in for what they are and give the person freedom how to meet those outcomes or whatever we want, criteria, whatever they would be, as opposed to a plan, because I don't see that happening. We don't have the, you know, acre lots with enough space to put a generic plan down. So I think that's a concern of mine too.
Yeah, I would almost like to eliminate that action item altogether.
We have grant funding for it. We can't eliminate it.
Okay, maybe can
and
we?
And the grant application was approved by city council.
Okay,
we're going to look at this.
Can we create it? Can we change it to standards?
No,
rather than plans.
No, that's not what we applied for the grant for.
And it doesn't mean that people have to use that. They can build their own. It's just a way to try to give streamlined approval for someone that has a light or a site that can be site adapted to the prototype and wants to use it.
Okay, are we gonna do it to a 2,400 square foot, 15% grade lot? Are we gonna do it to a 2,800 square foot, 3,200?
It's gonna be a challenge for the folks involved, and this is something that a lot of jurisdictions have asked for the state to do statewide, and the state has said it's impossible. Like you're saying,
yeah,
it's impossible just for your relatively small city. So
right.
I think it's going to be a design challenge that will be really interesting from my perspective. But yeah, it's not going to work for every site.
And we are partnering. We are looking to partner with some of the other jurisdictions in the county to develop these.
Okay.
The ADUs that are built in this city are largely very small.
Right.
So it's not as difficult as you might think. It's just I don't know how we're not exactly sure how often it would be they would be used, but. in general, the ADUs that we're building are in like the 500 square foot range and smaller.
I think if I'm looking at this right, I mean, I think Jerry's point is well taken. You know, every garage is going to be a little different. Every, you know, ADU is going to be a little different. I think what I see working in this would be a tiny house, an Appendix Q CRC, California Residential Code type of design, where you have a 250 square foot footprint, and you have the loft, and you have, you know, everything that Appendix Q allows you to do. You know, the egress is actually in the roof. In a 250 square foot area, that may work excellently. Anyway, I digress. I'm sorry.
I agree with you, but I just don't see us putting that into the beach track. You know, where you have 5 foot setbacks all the way around. I don't see it putting into, you know, North Main Street. You got, you know, or you're going to put it in a Del Mar track where you got 8,000 square foot lots. You know, there's just such a. We've got the grant funding. I guess it's going to go ahead.
Well, if you only need 12 by 12 footprint, you know, that's not very big. I mean, right. People can squeeze 12 by 12 anywhere. You know, you could throw in little tiny house, Appendix Q type of dwelling in there. I think that's what that says to me. I don't know.
Okay. Well, I thought this was to be a cost saving effort for the owner, and you know, my concern was that it would be a sizable cost to Scott's office. But now that I'm hearing that the grant money is available, it won't cost his office, and we have something available. Whether it might not work, but then in some cases it might work. In which case, it saves the homeowner wants to build anything some money. All right, that strikes me as reasonable.
Okay. Well, it looks like we've got a. Let's go ahead and move on. It looks like we've got grant funding. It's already been set in motion. So,
just on foundations.
Yeah. Okay, so we're through 20, 21, and 22. Any comments on those?
I just like to take a break if we could. We've got 10 pages left.
What was that, Michael? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I was wondering if we could take a break after this one.
Okay, well, we're into the H2s, so why don't we take 10 minutes then? Perfect. Okay. Okay, let's move on here. So H2, so protect and conserve existing housing stock. Sure, no let loss in existing housing. So we've got 2.1 through 2.6. Any questions or any comments?
There's actually 7 on my list.
Oh, okay. That's on the next page on mine.
Okay.
So let's do that.
This is where some of Ms. Winter's comments come in. 2.4 says support improvements to existing mobile home parks to preserve affordability. And I think that one is probably reasonable. I didn't know if there was any text in that one that we thought needed to be modified. I think there's some down in the next implementation action down in 2.1.4 that we could look at, but that one struck me as satisfactory at this point.
If I had a general comment, there's a lot of comments, but not a lot of how we're going to enforce. So, like, for example, you know, policy H2.1, how are we going to enforce the Section 8 subsidy that the homeowners or the owners consider it?
I think that goes into the implementation actions. And then on 2.7, it's discouraged large single-family home development. Are we talking about that on the large lots, or are we just talking about that on the R3 and R4 zoning, basically the down zoning? Scott, what's the focus of that?
My read is just, you know, we have multifamily residential lots, and our current zoning allows for development of single-family homes on them. This is another one of those policies that gets at not doing that, right. I think, is my take. Yeah.
Okay, as long as we're not trying to restrict the mix of housing on the R1, you know, just so long as I'm not reading that wrong, it seems like that's what it's doing, is trying to allow maximum density. But
well, in a way, I mean, in my mind, it's I had an example of a 1950s house on the middle of three lots. And the people wanted to tear down the house and rebuild it, and we talked to them about trying to maximize the density and made sure that they were aware of the opportunities on the site rather than doing the same thing again and precluding two other new homes.
Okay.
And I think it looks at, you know, it's like, hey, you have multifamily, you know, zoning, build multifamily housing as opposed to the building below the density that would otherwise be allowed if you're building, you know, if you're building multifamily housing, you get higher densities. If you're building single family houses in a multifamily zone, you're putting multiple ones on those units, you're going to get fewer of them. I think it's looking at all of those things.
Okay, that's how I read it. I just wanted to be sure. You know,
yeah, so. I don't think it has anything to do with. There's nothing inherently bad about larger homes, and especially when you have a lot of the areas in town where we're sloped have larger lots, and you have multiple stories to develop them. I mean, larger homes on those size lots make sense. I mean,
yeah. Okay. So moving on to the implementation items. We've got H 2.1.1 through 2.1.3. Anybody have any comments on those or issues? Okay, then 2.1.4 and 2.1.5. Any notes on those?
2.1.4 was the one that I think it's written from the owner's perspective, which I think is fine to make them aware of that. But I think we might add another phrase in there that maybe says, and maintain low-income affordability. Because upkeep of the economically viable mobile home parks, economically viable sounds like the developer term for the owners of the park. And that's fine, because you want them to be maintaining and doing upkeep to make them, you know, attractive and livable, but you also want to balance that with maintaining low income affordability, because we don't have very many places besides that.
So the way I read this is written to the owner, the park owner that owns both the lots and the houses and is renting them out. It's got to, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, where it's not written, what it's not written to is to what you said, Michael, is to the park owner that leases the ground sites out and then to individual owners. And so we've got a conflict there where the park owner wants to maximize their profit to remain viable, and while the mobile home owners, the homeowners, want to minimize what they pay for the land lease.
I think what this is referring to is to make sure that they can continue to operate it as a mobile home park, because some of those sites have a higher and better use. And we'd like to maintain the number of affordable mobile home park sites. So make sure that we're helpful to the property owner so they can continue to operate it as it is.
Okay. It seems like we want to try to have both of them, you know, both modes for both, try to encourage both, you know. So
the NPROG program, the funding source that's listed there is an HCD program, and the intent is to help the residents as well. I was just looking back at the webpage for that program. So basically to finance preservation of affordable mobile home parks by conversion to ownership or control by resident organizations, nonprofit housing sponsors, or local public public entities. So part of this program is part of this Morro Bay housing element program is referring to the opportunities under that state program. So I think it is, the intent was not just to serve the owners.
Okay.
Hey, Jerry.
Yeah.
I have a question. Does anyone have an idea of the adequacy of the state stabilization regulations? Because I'm not at all familiar with it, but the assumption I read into that is that if we adopt those regulations, we're okay to prevent skyrocketing rents in the mobile home parks. Should somebody give me sort of a nutshell explanation of what that means?
We have our own rent stabilization ordinance.
I'm sorry?
We have our own rent stabilization ordinance in mobile home parks.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good. So do we want to add anything to this item? Michael had a...
The only thing I was going to say is that could we say something like the city will promote the continued use and upkeep of economically viable. That says that the policy is to maintain the use there. And then by keeping park owners and individual homeowners, mobile homeowners informed of opportunities.
I think that's a good addition. Do we have agreement on that? Okay, I see nods. So, Amy, is that a problem? Okay. Okay, so 2.1.5. Any issues with that on the conversions?
I had a question on 2.1.7.
Okay.
Unsafe dilapidated housing units, code enforcement. In a lot of cases, these homes maybe, have an elderly person living in them or somebody who just doesn't have the means to bring it up to whatever code it needs to be brought up to. Could in lieu fees be used to provide assistance for income qualified people to help them stay in a home but bring it up to a better standard? Is that a possible use? So in other words, not creating a brand new, income qualified home, but allowing somebody to stay in the income qualified home that they have that is sort of dilapidated.
If we had a home, repair program.
Because that's something to consider. This town has a lot of homes that are in that category.
The city had a program through CDBG many years ago, and I think the CDBG and home funds that we used was a home rehab program, and we still get money back every once in a while when folks sell their houses that were part of that.
I know Cap Slow does stuff like that. I don't know if they'll do that in the city limits, but I see them do that in the county all the time. I'm assuming they would do that countywide. Even in the cities, but they do have programs like that, like low-income loans or no-interest loans at all or something like that.
Yeah, we used to have, a contingent of community development, a person in community development that did that well before I got here, but that managed the program. And then with budget cuts and that type of thing, that position went away.
Well, would that be something anybody would want to add or maybe add an investigation of a way to do that?
I think that would be a good program if there is a funding source. And I'm
thinking of the in lieu fees as part, some part of the funding source. And I know they're pretty depleted right now, so.
Yeah.
Generally don't have much.
Yeah, they typically don't have much. I think we would need to be looking for some grant programs or something outside or a, a nonprofit organization. The helping, self-help building, self-help. I think they have programs that use that. So I think we need to do something in conjunction with them or with somebody like that. Yeah. So I don't know how we would.
Well, I think that's when the code enforcement officer and Scott and, you know, the building inspector, they start talking to these folks about the potential resources listed in 2.1.7, you know, caps, lows, people self out, those types of nonprofits, churches, you know, churches sometimes can get involved and help, you know, someone who's, you know, potentially going to lose their house because of code enforcement issues. You know, that's what churches, in my opinion, that's what they exist to do, is, you know, that kind of work. So
maybe if we have something like saying that the city will direct the owners to available programs to retrofit or upgrade their
homes. It does kind of say that. It says offer to provide homeowners with a list of potential resources. I was just trying to figure out, you know, maybe a way to help them through the city financially with the in-lieu fees. But again, we don't really have any right now, so.
Yeah, I think funding would be the big problem there.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, never mind.
If we can, kind of, I wanted to go through the implementation action so I can kind of readdress my first statement, which, you know, we start talking about policy H2.1, talking about enforcing the Section 8 subsidies and that owners consider Section 8 vouchers. So that's a problem. I mean, that's a problem in the city that folks don't, owners of properties don't want to rent to Section 8 renters. How do we exactly intend to enforce this?
Well, I think there's state law coming down, or has been approved on that.
The law is
required.
They're required to accept them. Yeah.
That doesn't require the owner to make their rent affordable. It just requires them to accept the Section 8 voucher from the tenant.
Yeah.
Okay. So are you content with that, Jesse?
I didn't realize that was a thing.
Fair housing section and implementation action, and I think that would fall under it. People could complain if they felt like people were not complying with that state law.
Would they be applying to complaining to HCD?
I'm just going to find the number for you. It's later in this chapter. So it's goal H6 and the policy and implementation actions under that goal. And it's H611, so CRLA handles the complaints.
Okay.
California Rural Legal Assistance.
And we actually maintain, we have handouts up front for they deal with a lot of stuff like this.
Okay. You satisfied, Jesse?
Yes, sir.
Okay, cool. Okay, goal H3, special needs, addressing needs, housing needs for special needs individuals and new or adaptive existing homes. We have policy 3.1 and 3.2. Any issues with those? Okay, then the implementation actions. We got H3.1.1, 3.1.2.
On 3.1.2, it might be my own hang up. the female headed households, is that politically correct to say single parent households? Or is it meant to be female headed households with children, and you would add single parent households with children? I didn't know if those were tied
to you guys. The data that is in the data packet is for female headed households, and that's what the section in the needs assessment portion of the document relies on, but it's really up to the city whether you want to say single parent households.
I'd like to make it broader, just because the demographics are always shifting, and you know, I especially when you have a gender-based thing like that, I'd want to make sure that everyone is covered that's a single parent, because that's a might be a different type of need
that we don't want to. So that terminology, because I had the same issue that you did, that terminology is throughout the document. So are you suggesting we change that terminology throughout the entire document?
Yes.
Actually, yes.
So I don't know if we can – we'd have to look at the data sources and see if that would be
– I know there's program types that are specific for certain groups.
There's data packs that HCD provides, and that's the labeling on the data pack. So we can't really change the name of the data without changing the source and the content.
So can we add single head of household, Amy?
Yeah.
Just do it. Just leave it. Leave the female headed households in there, and just add single households as well.
Yeah.
Well, I have a little bit of a problem with that too. So what if there's two females and children in the household? I mean, that's a female headed household, but that's not really what this is supposed to be.
The
for,
intent
right?
is that there's only one parent.
Right.
Of that data. Yeah. That's the intent. That is what the data is about. Yeah.
I could see leaving the data as is, because that's quoting another source. But when we're talking about our city and our implementation actions, I think we could go to single parent household and sort of cover all the politically correct bases that way. So does that?
I would suggest that we look back at where that occurs in the whole document, and we'd be happy to work with staff to come up with a recommendation. I totally understand the sensitivity around that, and I think it's important.
Well, one of the things I'd be worried about on that too is that, you know, female even head of households are still making 78% of what a male head of household would make, or, you know, so their income. So I think this was set to help identify that problem. So if we dilute through political correctness, dilute that resource for them, what are we doing to that?
Yeah, so I think, again, we can look back at it and maybe be a little more nuanced in talking about gender and make sure that we're explaining the data correctly, but also that we recognize that all single parent households could have a tougher time than two parent households.
Yeah, I think adding the single parent household will pick all the other letters that kind of get missed by this binary system.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, we got agreement on that, guys?
I don't know. What did we agree on?
We're adding single parent household to that sentence.
I don't know. I think I still have issue with that.
We got all night.
I don't want to take all night on this. It hits me in a weird spot. Like it probably hits Michael in a weird spot.
Yeah.
I mean, the gender fluidity and people's, you know, ability to, I don't know, just gender in here seems inappropriate, just generally.
I agree. I would just go with the single, eliminate this female-headed household in this section where we're talking about our city's implementations. Go with single-parent household. You're identifying a group that's considered having more challenges and special needs and generally are lower income. You could have a very wealthy female head of household, single mom. You could have a transgender person. You could have – so, I think that – I think you're looking to identify these lower income, and so that's what we're looking at. And these are examples of things that we might look at. But I think just single out females – perhaps.
But there may be programs specifically set for female-headed, single female-headed households.
And they will find them then.
But then they would be lumped in with the single parent household rather than the female-headed household.
Mm-hmm. I think we get the gist of what the commission's interested in.
Yeah.
Let us go take a look at it, and we'll report that back to the city council that you had this issue, and this is how we resolved it, and they can make it, you know, and we can go from there. Is that acceptable?
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Great, Scott. Okay. So I didn't lose my place. We're on H4, goal H4, homelessness. Provide safe housing and shelter opportunities for homeless persons in Morro Bay, which we have been doing quite frankly, a shitty-ass job.
But a technical term, planning.
You're still on TV, Jerry.
Pardon the French. Okay, so who wants to go on this? Do we want to? We got policy 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, and 4.4. So who wants to take a shot?
The only thing about this that struck me is I think one of the commentators gave us some text about this as well, but it struck me that in the regional nature of what's being discussed here, it sounds as if we're going to ship them out. Yeah. And I think that in H4.2, we could say something, work with churches, other organizations to find opportunity for sheltering the homeless, medical care, job search assistance, and other identified needs, preferably in Morro Bay or in Morro Bay. Just directly say that our preference is, the policy is to have it happen here, not ship the problem to somebody else to solve.
I think we need, go ahead, other people. I've commented on this before, so.
I was looking at this, and there may be something going on, but I'm not aware of the neighboring communities of Cayucos and Los Osos and Morro Bay working together. I'm sure if I'm wrong about that, but it just seems because of the proximity of these three communities, these cities should really be working together, because I don't think, for some reason, some of Morro Bay's homeless people end up in Los Osos. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination that's shipping them out of town. I think these three communities should really be talking about this one region together. So So what do I mean? So in implementation 4.1, it might be the city will cooperate with neighboring cities in particular, something like that, to call attention to the need to sort of open up some dialogue with Cayucos and Los Osos. That's
okay, it. Jesse?
I think it's pretty well stated when it says work with regional nonprofit agencies on shelter solutions. And I think Joe hit it right on the nail on the head. This is a regional problem. As I drive around the county, I see different people, I hate to say this, but it's just kind of true where, if folks that may be homeless but have a car may want to congregate in a different part of the county than folks that without a car or different circumstances within their homelessness contribute to where they want to be. So it's a regional problem that is only going to be solved regionally. But I think policy 4.1 kind of nails it pretty good.
Susan, did you have anything to?
Just that I agree. I think Morro Bay is too small a community to be able to come up with single solutions, for shelter. I think it's going to take a regional approach, even if it's just a coastal approach and sort of a creative approach to safe parking areas and in addition to safe places just to camp out. I think this is pretty comprehensive.
Okay, well, one of the problems I have with all of this is pushing it into, when we're trying to create regional solutions, nothing gets done. And it hasn't gotten done. They are the homeless are here, they're under our bridges, they're in our creeks, they're in the state park. This is not a solution to say that they all should be sheltered in San Luis or they all should be sheltered in Atascadero. It doesn't work. There was a campsite, on Dog Beach that was there for 2 weeks. till the sheriffs came to break it up. You know, if you drove by the off ramp on Morro Boulevard, there was a huge encampment there in the you know, they're basically camping in the roundabout. They're here. You know, they're creating a hygienic problem, and we're not gonna, just by saying we need to have a regional solution doesn't solve any of the problems at all. Nobody wants to take responsibility for any of this because it creates adversarial, you know, situations. But we need to be setting up, you know, some safe parking sites that can be monitored, so that they're at least, we're not putting people in harm's way. We're having, you know, sanitary facilities, even if it's just an outhouse. I mean, even if it's a porta potty, that's better than having them, you know, defecating on the beach or defecating in the creeks and having that carried out to the bay or the creeks. So,
but don't you see that as something we would work with Los Osos and Cayucasan? You know, there's this stretch here, and that's going to include county. And I'm not saying you send people to San Luis Obispo or Atascadero or anywhere else, but I feel like Morro Bay is too small by itself to solve the problems, and it's also suggesting that there are borders that are artificial.
No, these we're not
traveling. Yeah.
Susan, we're not going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. But what we're going to do is we're going to create, you know, we need to create a space for our own benefit. This is not, you know, this is not philanthropy. This is not, you know, altruistic. I'm worried about the hygiene of me going out into the ocean water or me going out into the bay and that directly affecting me, because what happens on the, you know, under the bridge, you know, affects the waterways, it affects the bay, it affects the beach. And we're not doing anything because we want a regional solution. We've got a certain amount of people here. We need to create a certain amount of safe spaces for them, especially during this pandemic. Especially during this pandemic.
Well, the safe parking thing is something that I'm not sure if it's of a county / nonprofit agency partnership or if it's just a strictly county thing. But county is doing those types of programs. But you know, there's a lot of folks that don't have cars either. So I mean, you know, it's fine for those folks with cars, but those folks without cars, there's nothing that doesn't help them. But there are some nonprofits that have that could use additional help, you know, in the shower trailer. You know, they'll come to San Luis and they'll allow folks to take a shower once a week. Maybe we can have the churches, or you know, encourage churches to partner up with these folks and maybe volunteer to man those types of facilities. Maybe we can get that trailer to Morro Bay once a week or once a month. Or
okay, well, for instance, Jesse, you know, I agree. You know, this is, but we've got city land where we're storing old boats and RVs for people in the valley just so they don't have to drive them back and forth. Why can't we transfer those to the safe parking lot and safe parking camping? I would rather have a safe spot for somebody to have temporary housing there than support somebody that doesn't want to drive his car back, doesn't want to drive his boat back and forth, and may never even use it for the next 3 or 4 years.
Just as a reminder, last 2 weeks ago, you added your desire to add a goal that would assist an emergency plan for a safe place for the homeless population.
Right.
That is not in the document because we haven't redrafted the document.
Okay.
With your comments, but that was in the staff report, and you also had a desire on inclusionary housing fees. So both of those will be in the redrafted document.
Okay, great. And then did we have that on an implementation action also, or is that just on the
policy? Well, I think once we draft the goal, then we'll draft the rest of it. But there wasn't time to redraft a document, and I didn't think anyone wanted to start over.
No. Thanks, Nancy. Okay. I just want to make sure. I guess I'm on my high horse, and I apologize for that. But
I think we all agree with you.
The staff report does say that it called for an implementation action.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. If I can add, I'm in agreement with Jerry in terms of I wasn't advocating a regional approach. I was just, you know, recognizing that there's probably, what, a mile that separates Cayucas from Morro Bay, and probably, what, a 4 or 5 minute drive that separates Morro Bay from Las Osas. That's something much different than this countywide regional approach, which I don't think would work. But, you know, something between the three cities could help out, I think.
All the help we can get.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to, I think it's just going to be all hands on deck because, because what we've been doing, it hasn't worked.
Well, I think you're onto something there with the parking area. And I remember when Richard was on the commission, he was, you know, very staunchly trying to get warming centers for, in the wintertime and using some sort of city resources or maybe even school buses or something like that, you know, just to keep people from, you know, passing away while it's, you know, extremely cold. So,
and even allowing tents, in the parking areas to, you know, for people that don't have cars to, you know, to allow temporary tents or, you know.
I just think that it's critical to state the problem and not try to evade the problem, because we could have a different political atmosphere at some point where this was totally ignored again. And there'd be no incentive because of the policies say we're doing regional cooperation. You know, I'm not against regional cooperation at all, but if we don't say we want to have the problem here solved here, wherever we can, that's avoiding the issue, I think. So
I think that's stated in H43, community involvement. I mean, I think you're right. H41 says regional homeless shelters, but the rest of it really can apply to our community. Right. And they're hopefully writing this other implementation.
Maybe it's just a Morro Bay community involvement.
Okay. Well, let's see what the other, with the addendum comes back at, the change comes back. And, okay. So any other, comment on that, or should we move on to H5? Okay, move on? Okay, moving on to H5, housing costs. Help reduce housing costs so more people can afford housing in Morro Bay. Okay, don't get me started. Okay, policy H 5.1, reduction in operational repair costs, H5.2, and then we go into implementation actions. Any comment on the goals or the policy? Okay.
I'd just comment that I think this is all, you know, great stuff to do, but I always feel like, especially the retrofitting is great, but it's initially expensive and hard for people to do. And you may see results down the road, but that could be a challenge for somebody who's already having challenges financially. I mean, there have been some programs. PG&E had some great insulation programs and that sort of thing. I think at one point they were even giving out refrigerators that use less energy.
There are some charity action, but most of this stuff's going to get done when the housing gets rehabbed.
Right.
Well, it's also, you know, there'll also be programs put in place through Monterey Community Power.
Yeah.
Right.
So they have programs that they have in the pipeline to assist with some of these things, and those will be coming out, you know, over time.
Okay. So implementation actions. H5.
The one thing up on the policy is when it talks about reduction in dependence on vehicular transportation, it never overtly talks about the larger transit networks, the county or working with whatever that group is. I'm not sure who runs the county buses and things like that. But
RTA.
when we put that project on, you know, Tascadero and Main Street there, that's going to be a bucket full of people who are probably going to need transit at some point, you know. And so this idea of just, you know, what's written there, I, because down below it does say, because I was looking to see, well, where does it say anything about, it, then 5.1.2 does talk about it. So it seems like 5.1.2 has the solution, but H5.2 up above in the goal section doesn't talk about public transit.
This is going to be an unpopular opinion, but I've always thought that paid parking downtown would be a policy that we could implement that would reduce dependence on vehicular traffic. But that's kind of went nowhere every time I brought it up. So,
we are looking at paid parking options right now.
Yeah,
for both on the waterfront and in the downtown, and we're looking at having it evaluated through a consultant.
Yeah, paid parking is, you know, that's important. You know, it's an important source. It's how St. Louis redeveloped their business district through parking meters. So
I'd also say that some of this has to do with where people live and where they work. And if you can live where you work, then your reliance on your car to get somewhere is going to go down. I will also say that the pandemic has been really great for I think I put gas in my car one time in 4 months, and my car is a gas hog. It's not using it, so there you go.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay, so implementation actions, 5.1.1, 5.1.2. Any additions or changes? Anybody wants to see on any of those? Okay, then let's move on to H6, equal opportunity, ensure equal access to sound, affordable housing for all persons, regardless of race, creed, age, or sex. Policy, we've got the policy 6.1, and then we've got the implementation actions 6.1.1, 6.1.2. And that's it. So,
hate to be this guy, but I mean, if we're talking about protected classes here, I'm wondering if it would be sound to include or orientation in that, race, creed, age, sex, or, you know,
if you need, yeah,
I'm sure they're included in the fair employment and housing portions because they're, you know.
So, Amy, what's the appropriate wording these days?
I don't know if gender would be covering that, gender and
identification,
preference, something like that. You can definitely.
Okay, the Supreme Court ruled that sex meant gender preference or orientation.
I'm not sure, but I guess I'm just saying maybe we should think about including some sort of reference there, whatever the politically correct term would be, just to make sure we're being inclusive. So,
or we could take out all the words and just say the city declares that all persons will have equal access to sound and affordable housing.
I like that.
Yeah, you don't really need to qualify it. It's just if you're human. You know, I mean, a dog maybe has some other rights too, and a cat, but you know.
Yeah, whatever we think of, but I mean, yeah, I think either put a term in there that's inclusive or remove all terms.
I'll just chime in on this one because I think this is a goal that HCD, if this one gets changed, they will want to look at it, the revisions. Beyond making it more expansive, if I totally hear what you're saying, Susan, but if it is not explicit, they might have a comment about that. I don't know for sure, but this is a goal, and the policies and actions within it that the state cares a lot about.
So then we might need to come up with some more terms that are more inclusive, that are more categories of folks to include in this.
Do we want to leave it with staff and with Amy to giving them the direction? I think everybody agrees on it. So,
we'd be happy to do that.
Unless, if we can eliminate the terms or add more, whichever's more appropriate, Amy.
Sounds good.
Okay. And then, so then we have the implementation actions. Anybody have an issue? The 6.1.1 or 6.1.2?
Oh, that pretty much spells it all out right there, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, then we're going in. We've got the table H46.
While we're talking about it, I mean, I guess I just don't see anything specifically talking about, you know, sexual orientation or, you know, transgender or, you know, making sure the all protected class, all folks that need to be protected are protected within the protected classes here. I don't see anything. Maybe that could be included there as well.
Yeah. So, Amy, you've got marching orders on that, too, to check that to make sure that that's all inclusive on the implementation.
Is that for action two or for both of the actions?
Probably for both of those.
Okay.
Okay, so then we're at the table H46. And the quantified objective summaries. Anybody have any issues with any of the numbers or the way they're portrayed?
I guess one of the things in the table with the footnote, it says there aren't any federally assisted affordable units at risk currently. But does this assume that if we have some, we're only going to maintain 5? Was the Haslow project in that category that we just passed?
So this is a very specific requirement from the state. The Haslow project wouldn't fall into this category because it's not in service yet, and the at-risk units are those that are potentially going to not be subsidized within 10 years, basically by 2030. Within 10 years of the beginning of your housing element planning period. So because you don't have any that are in that category, the state wants you to have something in this category, in this table. It's not very quantifiable. So if you want this to be a different number, that's probably fine. We don't think that HCD would have a big issue with that as long as it's a higher number. But there aren't any projects that trigger this part of the state law currently in Morro Bay, so there isn't really anything to tie it to in terms of what number is included.
I just didn't want to give the sense that if we would be successful in getting some of these extremely low or very low numbers, we wouldn't want to lose any of them. So if the preservation objective is 5, I would almost rather see a percentage there of let's save 95% of them. You know.
If you wanted, you could include the numbers that are corresponding to the projects that you already have. You do have several assisted unit projects already that are constructed. That just none of them are currently. They're not at risk because basically the organizations that manage them are keeping them affordable. So it's really up to you.
And are those, Amy, are all those locked in past the time period of this housing element?
Right. And there's analysis of that in the needs assessment section.
Okay. So, Michael, what would you want to do?
Account for it in here, honestly. given that we don't have any at risk, they're saying we have to put something in here anyway. It makes little sense to me.
It's yeah, I don't really agree either. It's a strange.
Yeah.
I would just rather put an asterisk there that says keep all of them that we have.
And there is an implementation action that says that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's state law was updated since the last housing element. There are really specific requirements for what the city and what owners are responsible for. It's all laid out in there. So it's probably something about state statute that needs to get cleaned up, why it has to be in this table.
Okay, you satisfied with that, Michael? Okay, I kind of see a nod there. So
yeah, I like I say, it's a very abstract thing since we don't have any. How many are we going to have? And you know, I just saw the table and thought, wow, why aren't we trying to save 20, even if we don't have to? You know, it just looked like, you know, another goal. If you get some, don't lose any. But, you know, I understand. These things take a long time to accumulate. So we'll be lucky if we have 5 to save, probably.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think it's the risk of them going out. They're all locked in past this time frame, you know, because we didn't do that good 25 years ago. So we have a recommendation to forward this to the city council to adopt the negative declaration and to approve the 23-28 housing element update. Scott, do we need a motion on this or?
Yep.
Okay, so would somebody like to make a motion?
I move we forward a positive recommendation for the city's housing element, including the numerous modifications suggested at this meeting by the majority nodding. Is there a more formal note on the Planning Commission agenda here?
So yeah, I mean you're be adopting resolution PC-1220 recommending approval of the housing element with the recommended changes from the Planning Commission.
Yes.
Okay. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. Does anybody want to discuss anything else?
No.
Okay.
I did want to say thank you for putting up with my commentary. I talk out loud a lot of times. I try to make it more pointed in the future.
Well, we've all, you know, I don't have any outbreaks. You know, I don't I don't go on any rants, so.
You don't even cuss, Jerry, I tell you.
Okay.
It was about something that is important.
Well, I apologize to everybody out there for my indiscretions, but if you knew me, you wouldn't be surprised.
Passion is good. Passion is good.
Okay. Scott, would you like to call the vote?
Sure. Commissioner Lucas?
Aye.
Commissioner Stewart?
Yes.
Commissioner Graffia?
Aye.
Commissioner Barone?
Aye.
Chair Lure.
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0. Thank you, everyone.
Okay. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Nancy.
Okay. Okay. So that was B1. Okay. new business. Don't see anything here. Unfinished business. We take care of everything as it comes up, so we don't have nothing. Planning Commissioner comments and future agenda items. Yeah, I think everybody's commented out.
I just have a question.
Okay.
If we got it, I'm sorry if we're missing it, but did we get the housing element? I'm sorry, the vacation ordinance, the vacation rental ordinance.
You don't have it yet. We are still working through it. In fact, I was emailing back and forth to the city attorney's office yesterday on some final changes to it. So I think we have it due back to the Vacation Rental Committee. Susan, have you guys received that back yet?
We have not.
Okay, I didn't think so. So it'll our final draft will go back to the Vacation Rental Committee, give them one last chance, I think. That's how we're doing it, to weigh in based on the changes that we provided, and then it'll be coming forward, I think, at the second meeting in August, which is the 18th. That was the last conversation I had with the city manager, was when we'd be bringing it back. So if it's not then it'll be the first one in September, but that's what we're shooting for. So
okay, since that's going to be very contentious, are we going to still try to do that Zoom, or are we going to?
It's going to be Zoom. We're not going into meetings anytime soon.
And Jesse, it's not going to be contentious. It's all just peace and love.
You can't please everybody. Somebody's going to be upset, I promise.
It was actually one of the great things about the process was that the committee had people from representing all parts of the community and the industry. And, of course, everybody's just bringing their own thing to the table. But it was a real collaborative effort. And everybody realized they had to give a little bit. Nobody got 100% of what they wanted, but nobody lost either. And it's just a proposal. Obviously, it's a draft. But I think we all came at it with the feeling that we wanted to be able to present a community effort, so that it would be approvable by the majority of the community. So, hope for good things.
Sure you guys did a fine job.
Well, and again, it's going to be the outreach to the community that sort of helps everybody get on board, so that the agencies who next have to look at it, like Coastal Commission, will say, yeah, this community was really behind it. So we'll be behind it too. That's kind of the goal.
Okay, great. Great, looking forward to that. Scott, did you have any other comments?
The Haslow project went to council on appeal at the last hearing and was approved. The appeal was denied. The project approved 4-1.
Awesome.
Was that the appeal based on the elevator?
That was one of the items in the appeal, yes.
Okay, just throwing this out there. Anybody else have anything they want to say before we adjourn?
Oh, I did want to bring something up. We may not have the August 4th meeting. You guys got through Housing Element today. Good job. And I don't think I'm going to – I'll verify tomorrow and send an email out to you guys, but I don't think we have any agenda items for the 4th.
Okay. Okay, good. It'll save me all this commuting time.
Yeah. So. I would say this really far in advance. I'll miss the second meeting in November, so –
Okay.
Yeah, thanks,
Jay. Okay. All right, guys. Hey, thanks for the hard work and, the thoughtful, interface of going through this. This was good work done by all. So at this point, we'll adjourn to the next regularly scheduled Planning Commission meeting. It's tentatively scheduled for August 4th, but maybe will be August 18th. At 2020 at 6 p.m. and we will be doing this through the virtue of electrons once again. All right, good night, all.
Thanks, Jerry. Good job. Thank you.